If you're a modem user and you live in the United States, now you can have quality, reliable internet access and support ACB radio at the same time. Easy Access USA gives you flat rate 56K internet access, two email accounts, and Usenet news groups for only $19.95 a month. And every month, $4 of that great price goes to ACB Radio, so we can keep bringing you your favorite shows and expanding our service. So don't delay. Switch today to Easy Access USA. Surf on over now to www.easyaccessusa.net. That's www.easyaccessusa.net. Or if you'd rather sign up over the phone, call them toll-free at 866-835-7872. That's 866-835-7872 between 8 a.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern. Easy Access USA and ACB Radio, working together to bring you the best.
As well as ACB Radio Mainstream,
The Cafe,
ACB Radio Treasure Trove, you can hear
live, unpredictable internet
on the ACB Radio Interactive. ACB Radio Interactive, playing music from
the 1930s and 40s,
the 50s and 60s,
the 1970s,
80s and 90s,
the hits of the new millennium.
ACB Radio Interactive comes to you from at least six time zones on three continents, bringing you the very best of
country,
top 40,
classic and modern rock,
new age,
folk,
the rare stuff out of the 50s,
jazz,
easy listening adult contemporary,
and more. Live, unpredictable internet radio.
ACB Radio Interactive.
For the latest breaking news stories, visit the ACB Radio newsroom at www.acbradio.org. All the news, all the time. From the world's leading news organizations like CNN, the BBC, the New York Times, the Toronto Star, the Wall Street Journal, and more. That's all the news, all the time, in the ACB Radio newsroom at www.acbradio.org.
If you'd like to keep up to date with what's happening on ACB Radio, then join ACB Radio Announce. It's an announcements-only email list that keeps you up to date with programming, scheduled outages, and other interesting pieces about the ACB Radio website. To join, send a message to majordomo at telepath.com and put subscribe ACB Radio-announce in the body of the message. That's majordomo at telepath.com with subscribe ACB Radio-announce in the body of your message. Keep in touch with ACB Radio, the station that's out of sight.
ACB Radio.org.
Good morning and welcome to ACB Radio Mainstream's coverage from the 40th Annual Convention of the American Council of the Blind for Thursday, the 5th of July, 2001. And I'm Jonathan Rosen. It's nice to have you with us bright and early on this Thursday morning. It seems to get earlier. And the general session hall seems to get less and less full at this time of the week The general session hall seems to get less and less full as the week progresses. As you can tell, I'm sleep deprived. Let's take a look at what is on the program this morning, though. The entertainment, which we'll hear shortly, is scheduled to be from Bill Wesluski of Des Moines in Iowa. At 8:30, things begin with the invocation from President Wayne B. Merkley. And he is also of Des Moines, Iowa, and he's from the He's in fact the president of the Des Moines, Iowa State Church of the Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints. At 8:30 a.m. After the invocation, we have an hour and a half assigned to ACB business. As I've mentioned throughout the week, progressively there is more time assigned for business as the week draws on, to the point that on Saturday it's pretty much all business. And of course tomorrow there is the elections, and we'll talk a bit about that later. Then we're going to take a look at the 1990s recollections from ACB past president Leroy F. Saunders. He was president preceding Paul Edwards from 1989 to 1995. And you may have heard Leroy's interview on Blindline a few weeks ago, because he has been tasked with being in charge of the organization of this convention. And if you've been listening throughout the week on ACB Radio Mainstream and ACB Radio Interactive, you'll appreciate that. That is a mammoth task. There's just so much going on.
Is there anybody at the piano?
So many meetings. We'll look at that with Leroy Saunders as past president, and look at what he remembers from his presidential days. At 10:15 a.m. we will take a break, and at 10:30 there will be three consecutive sessions. This is something that was done as a bit of an experiment last year, and I guess the judgment is that the experiment was a success because they're repeating it this year. So there are three breakout groups. The first one is Getting to the ATM Safely, and that combines two issues: pedestrian safety, and Julie Carroll of Virginia will be talking about that, and accessible AGMs. Lainey Fingold will be talking about that, of California. Now the second workshop is Communicating Rather Than Stressing. Oh yeah, can relate to that. Pam Shaw of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and of course she is the second vice president of the American Council of the Blind. And C, the third workshop, DVS in Your Community. Mary Watson, a name that's very familiar to many of you, from WGBH in Boston, Massachusetts, will be presenting there, as well as Kim Charlson of Watertown, Massachusetts, and Joel Snyder of Washington, D.C. There is an adjournment at 12 noon. Now, I stand to be corrected on this, but last I heard, it was the workshop on communicating without stress that we will be able to broadcast. So that may, in fact, change, and we'll probably find out the venues when we convene at 8:30. Whichever of the sessions is in the General Assembly Hall is, of course, the one that we can stream. So stay tuned, and we'll bring you up to date with further information about that. Also, something additional, which we weren't originally anticipating streaming. This afternoon, the ACB governmental employees are meeting.
Okay, Mrs.
And there is a workshop that's taking place. Two, in fact. One is on the important subject of why are 70% of Americans still unemployed. I know there'll be a lot of interest in that. And the other is an update on Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act, which is now in full force and hopefully is making a difference. We, at this stage, will be able to stream you both of those important workshops live. I believe the first one starts at 2:15. And so what we'll probably do is take a break and go and replay some of the morning's convention session and cut that at 2:15 and come back live and broadcast that for you. So stay tuned, and we'll try and give you more information on that. Obviously, we're keen to give you as much coverage as possible, and since it's in this room, well, we can stream it, so we're going to stream it. I'd like to wish a special good morning to those people listening on radio information services or other media besides the internet. We certainly appreciate you're tuning in, and invite all of you to give us an email at any time if you have any questions or comments that you want to pass on. convention@acbradio.org is the email address. That email address again is convention@acbradio.org. We've received a large number of very positive emails, and we appreciate that, including a message from Pat and Marvin Price. Very nice to hear from you both, and they say they haven't missed a minute of the general session, and in fact in some cases they've heard it more than once when it's been on the replay. Also Jenny and Fleming Guide Dog Fleming from southeastern Kansas have been tuning in. Jenny hasn't been to a national convention of the American Council of the Blind before. She's been to a state convention. Wasn't really sure what to expect, and appreciates, of course, that it is a major undertaking to come to a convention like this. It can be a bit stressful for guide dogs. And so she's been able to sample what it's like at a convention by tuning into ACB Radio Mainstream, and now she's more au fait with what it's all about, and this is more fun to attend. So thank you to Jenny and Guide Dog Fleming from southeastern Kansas for your email. And Joe Sorensen has also dropped us an email, and thank you to you, Joe, for your continued support and listening to the coverage here on ACB Radio Mainstream. Tomorrow there will be elections in the American Council of the Blind. What's happening at the moment, and has been steadily occurring throughout the week, is that state affiliates are caucusing. They get together and they hear from the candidates. They can ask questions. The candidates seek to convince those in attendance that they are best for the future of the American Council of the Blind. Those caucuses are continuing, and also this evening, in preparation for the elections tomorrow, there is a candidates forum taking place. Now there are some logistical issues with the venue here. We are unable to hold it in this room where we're doing the General Assembly, and therefore we are unable to stream it. It was our intention to do that, but it just hasn't been possible, and there's no way that we can do it. So apologies for that. But there is a lot of interest in the candidates forum this year, and there's been, my understanding, a record number of questions submitted by people in attendance here at the convention to the Board of Publications. People go to the press room and they put a question in a box, and people from ACB National Office, I think Penny Reader, as editor of the Braille Forum, ACB's official publication, has been tasked with trying to consolidate the questions as much as possible so that people's queries can be answered, at least as many of them as possible. So that will take place this evening for those in attendance here at the convention as they prepare to vote. Tomorrow morning, we hope, and obviously duties may not permit this at the last minute because that's part of being president of a large consumer organization at convention time, but we have tentatively arranged to interview the outgoing president of ACB, Paul Edwards, at approximately 8:15 central time tomorrow morning towards the beginning of our coverage. So that would be about, I think, 1:15 universal time.
Well, no, what they would do, Jay, is swap.
Yeah, I believe that's the case. It's a bit heavy going. That is right. 1:15 universal time. I'm used to calculating it from my own time zone. I want to give people a chance to hear from Paul, if we can manage it, so that the many people listening outside of the US or who are not members of the American Council of the Blind can get an idea as to what's going to happen tomorrow, so that you can listen to the elections being conducted with some idea as to what to expect and what's actually going on, trying to make sense of it all. So that's going to be happening, with a bit of luck, tomorrow morning prior to the convention reconvening, an interview with Paul Edwards, president of ACB, to talk specifically about the procedures that will be in force for the election. Tomorrow ACB will be electing a new president, a new first and second vice president, a new secretary, and a new treasurer. So there will be a completely new set of offices. So that's all coming up tomorrow. I think there is one person who currently holds an office who is seeking another one in terms of office holding positions. But no person will have the same office after the selection process because there's no one seeking re-election for their current position. A lot of that is due to term limits within the American Council of the Blind. You can only serve 3 consecutive terms in one position, and that's why Paul, I guess one never knows whether Paul would seek re-election or not if he were able to, but he isn't, and that's why we're seeking a new president here at ACB this year. So that's an update as to what's happening. If you have any questions that we can answer for you or comments that you would like to pass on, our email address here at the Polk County Convention Complex in Des Moines, Iowa is convention@acbradio.org. That's convention@acbradio.org. And we will keep you up to date with additional coverage, including which workshop we'll be broadcasting and the details about something extra this afternoon, the seminars from the ACBGE, ACB Governmental Employees, on Section 508 of the Rehab Act and the important question of the 70% unemployment rate among blind Americans. Let's go to the entertainment now.
Danny Do Nothing.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank our entertainment this morning very much, Mr. Bill Wozlowski from Des Moines, Iowa. Bill, if I could play like you, I wouldn't be up here. That's excellent. Good morning, everyone. Very glad that you're here. Very glad that we're able to move on with this morning's session. To begin this morning's session, it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you for our invocation Wayne B. Merkley, who is the president of the Des Moines State of the Church of Latter-day Saints. For our invocation this morning, Mr. Merkley.
Thank you. Our Father in heaven, in sincere prayer and with gratitude in our hearts to Thee, we open the proceedings of this day of the American Council of the Blind. We acknowledge our dependence upon Thee. We are grateful unto Thee for fashioning the great plan of happiness in which we are engaged. We acknowledge that this great plan provided for us to leave Thy presence and come as mortals to this earth, whereby we have the privilege of being tabernacled in a body of flesh and bone. And though we knew before we came to earth that our bodies would be subject to all kinds of infirmities, inadequacies, imperfections, and yes, even death, we chose to accept any and all eventualities such that we could make ourselves eligible to return again to Thy presence. We have gathered here today to celebrate our spirits, for it is our spirits which allow us to rise above our imperfections, even to soar above our inadequacies. We invoke Thy Spirit to attend the proceedings of this day, that presenters will edify and listeners will process and understand, that all may rejoice together and rise up and call Thee blessed. This is our petition to Thee, in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen. Thank you so much, sir.
My pleasure.
Very, very much appreciated. Thank you for coming, Brian.
Nice to meet you. I'll be with you. Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a few announcements. Here is the first one. Attention, science fiction, horror, and fantasy fans. A social will be held tonight from 9 to midnight in room 200-4 at the Kirkwood Hotel. Ice cream, refreshments, and other goods will be served. Other goods? Goodies. Oh, that makes more sense. $5 at the door to cover expenses. Call Josette at the Kirkwood at 200... It says sort of 200D here, so it may be 200-4, it may be 200D. So, the Florida delegation will caucus in room 204B at 12 noon today. This change was necessary due to room usage for the late morning breakouts.
It says breakout.
We apologize for the uncertainty with regard to special interest seating. We're trying to make a decision, and we haven't made it yet because we're looking at some numbers up here. We will be having our breakout sessions at 10:30, and I'm going to spend a minute or two describing what each of them is. Actually, I'm going to spend a minute describing what all three of them are. The first one is interesting because it's a program on communication. President Danny Do-Nothing is going to be presiding at one of our councils of the blind, whose name at the moment I've forgotten because I know nothing. And
difficult council of the blind.
It's the difficult council of the blind. That's right. I don't know where difficult is. I think it's a little west of I was going to say Des Moines, but I decided I better not. The second of our breakout sessions is, how do you actually help your community to broaden its involvement with descriptive video? That is, how do you persuade theaters to become more interested in creating theaters where you can actually go to movies and see descriptive video? How do you work with your communities to ensure that your local public television station is maximizing its use of descriptive video? And how do you encourage, if you happen to live in one of the larger markets, your cable companies and others, to be sure that they're doing the right thing with regard to video description? So that's the second breakout. And the third one is actually going to be not just about pedestrian safety, but also about ATMs and how we can work to deploy those, how we can work to make traveling to ATMs safer, and a whole range of other kind of environmental elements will all be taken into consideration. So it's not a single subject. We're actually looking at a number of safety issues and a number of issues around the built environment. So those are the breakouts. What we're trying to determine now is which is going to be where a little bit. Everybody thought they knew yesterday, but I'm being difficult as the president because of my concern about which of the three we're going to stream. And I'm taking a look at the numbers of people who pre-registered for them, and we'll try to make a decision within the next few minutes.
Mr. President?
Yes, sir.
This is Mr. Doughton. I just want to let everyone know that we know about a set of speakers in the back here on the far right that are off, and I'm going to get them turned back on as quickly as we can.
Thank you very much, Mr. Doudna. So I apologize to special interest affiliates who have been disenfranchised this morning. If there are roll call votes, we'll establish a spot where you can stand and we'll provide you with tin cups.
A fundraiser.
Michael Byington up here says, actually, that's a fundraiser. Ladies and gentlemen, the job of being president of the American Council of the Blind is a difficult one at best. For me, over the past 6 years, trying to be president of the American Council of the Blind and at the same time manage to hold down a full-time job, make some effort at running a house and maintaining a relationship, are all difficult balls to juggle together. It would have been absolutely impossible for me to have juggled all of those balls were it not for the fact that I have the privilege of working with a first vice president who was prepared to take up the slack wherever I asked him to do that. Sometimes that meant doing really hard jobs like making lists of names and getting information out. Sometimes that meant actually standing in for me when I simply wasn't able to get away. Last fall, for example, when I called him around midnight from the front porch of my house with water up to my knees and said, "Brian, I can't be at a meeting. Can you go tomorrow?" Brian said, "I'll make it happen." It's that kind of dedication and willingness to help. It's that kind of ability to stand in at the last minute that characterizes our first vice president. It gives me great pleasure to ask him to take over this morning and preside. Mr. Brian Charlson of Watertown, Massachusetts.
Good morning, ACB. Time to do business. Time to do business. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to ask that we try to be courteous to one another this morning. And the first thing I'm going to do, because I do believe that you do as you say, as you ask others to do. My father might disagree with that. But generally speaking, I like to do what I ask others to do. So I'm holding in my hand a little thing called a cell phone. Turn them off, ladies and gentlemen. While I appreciate you all want to be connected to the outside world, we need your attention here this morning. We're going to be doing some important business on behalf of the American Council of the Blind. We need your undivided attention during that time. Second thing I want to tell you is that we're going to be discussing Constitution and bylaws changes and resolutions this morning. The sign of a true democracy is when the minority opinion can be heard in a courteous manner, and the majority opinion adopted. Let's see to it that we do that this morning and honor those who have different opinions than ours during those debates. Let's start this morning by dealing with bylaw changes, and I will turn the microphone over to our able chairman of that committee, Kathy Wheeler.
Good morning. The committee members are Steve Dresser, Ray Campbell, Scott Stanger, Frank Kuda, and Don Thompson. You can now clap because that was all correct. Yesterday, when we read an amendment having to do with vacancies among the officers, the president asked me to check in the Constitution and find out about references to vacancies. On page 15 of L, it says, if a vacancy should occur between annual conventions in any elected positions on either the Board of Publications or the Board of Directors, except in the office of President or First Vice President, the Board of Directors shall, by a majority vote, elect an individual to serve in the position until the next annual convention. That is all that applies right here, and in no other place are vacancies discussed. So the amendment that arose because of that is one that we read yesterday and we will read and debate today. It's the amendment itself would go on page, it refers to page 16. Amend Article 4 by inserting a new Section M, a new Section N, and relettering appropriately. The new sections would read, M, should a vacancy occur in the office of the President, the first vice president shall automatically assume the presidency and shall serve the remainder of the term. Section N. Should a vacancy occur in the office of the first vice president, the second vice president shall automatically assume the office of the first vice president and shall serve the remainder of the term. I move the adoption of this amendment.
Motion has been made and seconded to adopt this amendment. I will entertain four speakers, two for and two against. Is there anybody who wishes to speak in favor of this amendment? Hearing no calls from the floor, anybody who wishes to speak against this amendment? Again, hearing no calls from the floor, we'll go to the vote. All those in favor of its adoption indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The ayes have it. Kathy?
Okay, now the next amendment is one that comes from the Constitution and Bylaws Committee. It is we call it a housekeeping amendment. There is a conflict in the Constitution, and one of our jobs is to make every effort to see that there aren't conflicts in the Constitution. These two amendments, I will read them together. I will read them and tell you that they both must pass or they both have to go down. But we will vote on them separately. On Braille page 27, amend bylaw 2A by striking out the first sentence and inserting, postmarked by February 1st of each year, the national office shall forward to each member at large written notification of the due date for annual membership dues. Postmarked by February 1st of each year, the national office shall forward to each affiliate a computer printout containing notification of the due date for mailing dues and a copy of the most recent membership list filed with the national office. So the current wording is, to facilitate the updating of voting membership records, a computer printout of each affiliate's membership record shall be sent annually to that affiliate. You see, it doesn't say in this who's going to send it. So we would have it say, postmarked by February 1st of each year, the national office shall forward to each member at large a written notice of due date of annual membership dues, postmarked by February 1st of each year, the national office shall forward to each affiliate a computer printout containing notification of due date for mailing dues and a copy of the most recent membership list filed with the national office. Okay, we are suggesting that you adopt that. And the one that we are going to strike out if you adopt this first one is on page 31. Amend Bylaw 3 by striking out Section F. On or before February 1st, the treasurer shall mail to each affiliate and member at large written notification of the deadline for mailing dues and required membership lists. So we vote on the first one. Mr. President, I move we adopt this amendment.
Motion made and seconded. Do I hear any discussion? Hearing no discussion. One moment. I hear a call for discussion. Get yourself to a microphone.
This is Chris Prentice from Texas.
You're recognized.
Mr. Chair, we would move to amend the proposed amendment to change the postmark date from February 1st to January 15th in order to allow 60 days for return of dues.
There's been a motion to amend. Is there a second? And a second. Debate is now on the timing. The debate is now on the timing. Shall it be the 15th of January or the 1st of February? Does anybody wish to speak in favor of the amendment?
Chris Prentice for Texas. I will go ahead and speak for my own amendment.
Please.
Based on the need to get the dues back in on time and the need to track down all members and bring in future members, we feel like 60 days is a better length of time than the 45 that we currently have, and feel like that would be in the best interest of ACB.
Thank you very much. Would anybody stand who wishes to speak against the proposed amendment? This is the amendment to the proposal of the committee. Hearing none, we're going to vote now on the date change. All those in favor of amending this proposal to reflect January 15th instead of February 1st, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The ayes have it. It is now changed to the 15th, and we move to the original motion to adopt this amendment. Is there anybody who wishes to speak to the amendment?
Brian, this is Al Pietrolongo from Maryland.
You're recognized.
I would like to offer a friendly amendment to add the words in print or by email. No.
I believe that that is ruled unfriendly, or at least not friendly, and would have to be... And I'm going to turn the podium over to the president to speak to it as a point of information.
I'm not at all suggesting to the maker of this friendly amendment that it's not a good idea. The difficulty here is that just as we require certified letters from you, it seems to me that the national office needs to be accountable as well and needs to stick to its dates. And therefore, there needs to be a way that that there can be unequivocal certification that things are being done in precisely the way that we ask them to be done, but also on January the 15th, as well as later when we ask you to send stuff back. So it seems to me that email doesn't work as an option there.
Do you wish to make your suggestion as a motion to amend, Al? He says no. I hear the lady calling for the floor. Could you get to a microphone?
This is for clarification.
Identify yourself.
This is Carla Rushball, Kentucky. Just for clarification, if we are sent a certified list, does this mean that we will not receive an email list? Can we also receive an email list upon request?
There's no reason for... I mean, that's up to you to arrange. I have no problem.
Okay.
If you've got an arrangement with the national office where you've been getting an email list, I have no problem with your getting an email list.
All right. Thank you.
I mean, there's nothing to preclude you getting additional lists. I'm merely suggesting that if there is something in the Constitution that calls for a specific action, that specific action needs to be adhered to. Any additional accommodations the national office makes to our affiliates are good things, yes?
Good. Just wanted to clarify. Sounds good to me. Thank you.
Could I ask a related question?
Please
that?
Identify yourself.
Lynn Zelvin from New York. Is there any particular reason, since this is obviously done as an access measure, where a computer disk cannot be included in a certified letter, which would fulfill the requirement of having the certified letter and being able to verify it?
I suppose. I mean, there are some occasions where disk versions are sent out by the national office. It's not, you know, we're frankly spending a lot of time debating practice rather than a constitutional amendment.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing that precludes the national office from making accommodations, particularly for larger affiliates, that enable them to more appropriately interweave our membership stuff into other things. We're still not there yet in terms of establishing a lot of the elements,
yeah.
But I don't think we need to spend time debating media here, guys.
Point of information, Jerry Nunzio.
Gentleman has a point of information.
It's Jerry Nunzio.
Please identify yourself.
There were two
Please
places.
Please identify yourself.
Jerry Annunzio.
Pardon me.
For the third time.
Here.
There were two places where the February 1st date was met. Are both of those changed to January 15th?
You want me to respond to that?
Sure. Go right ahead.
We're only dealing with the First Amendment now.
Yes.
So that,
but in that paragraph, there were two.
So that if the
two sentences fall, and you both have.
My assumption would be that the person making the amendment and the passage of the amendment would change to January 15th wherever February 1st occurs.
Thank you.
I'm going to put springs on his backside. He's been popping up so fast, I have to dodge. Hearing no further call for debate, we'll move to...
Mr. Chairman,
pardon me,
Frank Cuta.
Mike Cuta?
Frank Cuta. I'm sorry.
Oh, you did say Mike, didn't you?
No, and it's the way that I say it, because many people have that same impression. It is Frank, okay?
I'm right. Frankly impressed.
I would like to speak at this point, I guess, against the bylaw. It was okay, but... The problem is that we amended this bylaw without due consideration. See, the reason these things have need to be brought to the Constitution and Bylaws Committee is because we look through the entire Constitution. If we now adopt this change, we change one date, and we have the date March 15th for other things in other parts of the Constitution. So we have a certain amount of congruity and compatibility, and that's what the Constitution and Bylaws Committee does. When there's a proposed change, we look through the entire document and verify that everything is, you know, fits. And so to make an amendment like this on the floor and to have a couple of pros and cons and then vote against it without looking at the entire document causes not serious problems. Right. You know, I mean, it's okay to have different dates in different places in the Constitution. All right? It's just I'm at the point now where I think it should go back to the Constitution and Bylaws Committee. So I would urge you to vote against this amendment.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Kuda, are you making a motion?
I am voting. Pardon me. I am speaking against the amendment as it has now been
amended.
Very good.
Very good. Is there anybody who wishes to stand and speak in favor?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Don Thompson, you're recognized.
Thank you. I hate to disagree with my friend on the committee. However, we have to pass it, even if we disagree with some part of it, because right now the organization is not doing what the bylaw requires that it be done. That is, the treasurer no longer sends out this stuff, and we need to pass both of these things. We can always go back and change it later, but we should not ever have our organization in conflict with the bylaw, and that's what's happening. So I think we have to pass it. We don't have any choice. Thank you.
Can we now move to the vote? All those in favor of adopting this amendment indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The ayes have it, and it's adopted. Kathy?
Okay, now the next amendment is the one that would strike out on or before February 1, the treasurer shall mail to each affiliate and member at large written notification of the deadline for mailing dues and required membership lists. This would be stricken. I move that we adopt this amendment.
Motion's made and seconded to strike the second to adopt the amendment which is calling for striking language, correct, Kathy?
Correct.
This amendment is, please specify.
The amendment is on page 31, on or before February 1st, the treasurer shall mail to each affiliate and member at large written notification of the deadline for mailing dues and required membership lists.
Bylaw 3 amendment 1.
What?
What's the number?
Bylaw 3. Bylaw 3 amendment.
Bylaw 3.
Amendment.
Let's see. No, it's Bylaw 3. It's the very top of Bylaw 3 on page 31.
Of Bylaw 3. Although, do I have any discussion? Hearing none.
Mr. Chairman.
The gentleman identify himself.
Sam Martinez, Arizona. I'm having some difficulty in coming to grips with this amendment, with this constitutional change. I understand the practice is that the national office sends out the notice. I feel very strongly that we need to keep accountability with our elected officials. So I would like to propose a friendly amendment.
No, they can't do that.
It'll be friendly.
In the wording of this, where we say the national office says that sends this out under direction of our treasurer.
It would not be considered a friendly amendment in that it doesn't relate to this section at all. Again, Kathy, would you please read the language that's to be stricken for the gentleman, please?
Okay, remember that we have adopted the other amendment which follows our custom. Our custom is that the national office sends out these printouts. We have adopted that. If we are not going to be in conflict with what we have just adopted, we have to strike out on or before February 1st, the treasurer shall mail to each affiliate and member at large written notification of the deadline for mailing dues and required membership lists. We want to take those words out of the Constitution.
Does the gentleman wish to make a motion?
Not at this time, thank you.
You're welcome. Any further debate on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. It is adopted. Kathy?
Okay. Now on Braille page 28, this amendment stands by itself. I think there may be a person in the audience who will defend why it's here. Amend bylaw 2. It's on page 28. It happens to be the same bylaw, but it's a different part of it. Amend bylaw 2A by adding the following phrase to the end of the section: a 2/3 affirmative vote of the board of directors. Now, the part that I'm going to read to you would be the proposed wording, and it would be the entire sentence that this applies to. It was felt that this phrase would give direction to who was supposed to take action if any action was determined needed to be taken. Okay, if an affiliate fails to comply with this section, this section is mailing in your dues and your lists each year. So, if an affiliate fails to comply with this section, the first year of noncompliance may result in diminished voting privileges, and the second consecutive year of noncompliance may result in revocation of the affiliate's charter by a 2/3 affirmative vote of the board of directors. Now, be aware that when the Constitution says shall, it is something which has to happen. And when the Constitution says may, there is a choice. So there may be diminished voting rights and there may be revocation of the charter. But the ones who will decide whether the charter is to be revoked would be the board of directors. So with that explanation, I move that we adopt this amendment.
Motion's made and seconded. Do I hear any debate?
Point of information.
State your name and your point.
Ken Stewart, CCLVI. The second provision seems to be rather than diminished vote. Isn't the intention that it would be at least a diminished vote the second year and a second sanction also possible?
Well, that's not the way it's written. If you want to change it, you amend it.
I'm asking for the intention. I would think the intention is to be a heavier sanction the second year, but the way it's written, it would...
Well, yes. Revocation of the charter is a whole lot worse than diminished voting.
But if there's no 2/3 vote, if it's a majority vote, let's say, if the 2/3 vote fails, the affiliate makes out better than they did the previous year. That's the point. Seems to me you want to have a diminished vote
and a second sanction. The process is that the credentials committee looks at when all of the membership information and dues were mailed in to the national office. If they're mailed in, first of all, if they're mailed in, then this doesn't apply. The second thing that happens is the date is checked. If they're mailed in on time, they are in compliance and all is well. If they are late, the credentials committee can diminish the number of votes they are allowed to cast on the floor.
My question
now, I get... if just one moment, please.
Sure.
If they do not send in a list for 3 years and there are no changes or anything like that, they just don't send in a list, then the board has to request recertification. That's a little bit higher up in this article, and I didn't read it. And if they ask for it, or when they ask for it, if an affiliate fails to comply with recertification the first year of non-compliance, the credentials committee says, well, you know, we probably will diminish their votes. And then the second year of non-compliance, the board may say, the board has to look at it, because they are the ones who will be taking action, if this amendment passes anyway. The board looks at it and says, well, do we want to revoke the charter? Because basically, there have been 3 years that they haven't sent in the list. We asked for recertification. Then that was the fourth year. They didn't send it in. The fifth year, they didn't send it in. We really better see whether we want to keep this affiliate on the rolls. This came up because, as we understand it, now remember I said as we understand it, Rhode Island is not active in any way, and it's not even possible to find people to ask, where are you, what are you doing? They just sort of have quit. And so the credentials committee said, how long do we keep the people on the rolls? And that was the reason for all of this. And so it's not a good idea to say, somebody do something. You're likely to get a whole lot more action if you say, it is your job to do something. And so this amendment says, board of directors, it's your job, if their charter is to be revoked, do it.
Madam Chairman?
Thank you. One moment. Did this answer the gentleman's question?
No, it doesn't. I didn't make myself clear. What? I strongly favor the intention of this amendment. Perhaps I should make a friendly amendment. I think if the second provision says, in addition to the diminished vote sanction, the second sanction should be possible. And the way it reads now, it seems like it's an instead of, and therefore there's a risk that the second year will be...
And I hear a cell phone in the room, ladies and gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, point of information.
Actually, sir, when you say may happen, there is a choice. If you want to make it stronger, change the may to shall. But be sure, if it says shall, then you have to do it. I mean, there may be extenuating circumstances.
I understand the nature of the gentleman's question. The question is that, as it's currently worded, in the first year, you may have diminished votes, but it doesn't say that you may have diminished votes in the second or third year. Is that your understanding?
Exactly.
And the President has asked for a moment to explain this from his perspective.
You know, there are two things that the word may does. The word may says you can exercise these sanctions, but it also leaves open all of the areas of action in between the two. It seems to me this is not something that ought to exercise us. The board of directors is very unlikely to revoke a charter with the two-thirds vote. And the chances are that even in a case where there's lots of evidence of non-compliance and even other things, I suspect that what the board will look for is an area somewhere in between the two. And I think that may, in both cases, allows both the credentials committee and the organization as a whole to exercise the whole range of options that are open to it in a very real sense. The specific list of elements here are simply suggestions the board of directors may avail themselves of.
Shelley Foley, I believe I heard your voice calling for the mic. Chair of our credentials committee. Shelley?
Thanks, Brian. Basically, this was because we've had the last few years, not just Rhode Island, there have been two or three, I think maybe even four different affiliates in which we have not heard from dues or lists. And basically, we decided this year we were going to try to do something which would actually deal with the situation rather than just keeping them on the roll year after year. And that's basically all it was meant to do. And I agree with the may in there. It leaves a little more room for exercising different options.
Thank you, Shelley. Any further debate? I hear a call for the question. Hearing no further calls for the floor, we'll move to the vote. All those in favor of this motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The ayes have it, and it's adopted. The President has an announcement or two to make, and I'm going to give him an opportunity to do that now.
Yes, there you are. See, it's lovely to have a compliant First Vice President.
Don't count on it.
He says not to count on it. First, we've sorted out what we're going to do with regard to rooms for the breakout session, so please listen carefully so that you know what this stuff is, or where this stuff is. Pam's section, that is the council meeting, will occur in rooms 141 through 144 downstairs. The descriptive video will be in rooms 137 to 140 downstairs, and the pedestrian safety elements of the ATM machine and so on will actually be here. And we will be streaming that whole segment on ATM machines and pedestrian safety live. So I'm excited by that. And that's one of the major reasons why we wanted to move it. While the do-nothing president is certainly an appropriate segment, we felt that there might be some more value in sending out information to the world about what we're doing about ATMs and pedestrian safety. So we really wanted to try to see if we could move things around so that we'd be able to do that. The other thing is I want to provide you with a little bit of information that because it was so popular yesterday, and I understand there were far too many people trying to participate so that there were other folks who wanted to get an opportunity to do some more. There will be another session of water aerobics this afternoon at 4. It'll be held at the Marriott Pool. And I'd like to express ACB's gratitude for work well done in terms of pulling this together to Jerry and Don Coors of Indianapolis, Indiana, and to Kim Wegel, who put it together. And so at the Marriott Pool this afternoon, water aerobics will happen again. And finally, for all of his work in putting together for the last few years our recreation zone, I really want to express my appreciation to Oral Miller.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. President.
Yes.
It's Mitch Pomerantz, ACB Government Employees, and since you were mentioning moving rooms, perhaps we should mention that our employment roundtable and the 508 seminar or discussion will be held, I believe, here in the Assembly Hall. And from what Terry informs me, that too will be streamed live.
Correct. So we believe that unemployment for people who are blind is an important issue.
And, thank you, Mr. President.
And since we have an opportunity to we also, by the way, believe that Section 508 deserves to be better understood by our members throughout the country and by folks throughout the world. So both of those sections will be streamed this afternoon. Yes.
Mr. President.
Yes.
Vernon Daigle.
Sir.
Just a point of clarification. On the room numbers for the breakouts,
yes.
Doesn't that encompass two corridors? Numbers and odd numbers?
We've moved the walls.
Okay. Good enough. Thank you.
We're good.
Mr. Charlson.
We'll be giving out those room numbers again. Don't worry if you missed them now. We'll do them again just before we leave. Now let's turn back to Kathy and the Bylaws Committee.
Okay. Bylaw page 23. Amend Article 6 by striking out the last sentence, a majority of affiliates. Oh, this has to do with quorum. A majority of affiliates seated and 25% of individual certified voting members shall constitute a quorum for transacting business. Currently, the wording is, a majority of all votes certified and seated at the convention shall constitute a quorum to do business. So we would change it to say, a majority of affiliate seated and 25% of individual certified voting members shall constitute a quorum for transacting business. I move the adoption of this amendment.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. The chair has a point of information or point of inquiry here. Is it my understanding that when you speak of certification, we're talking about certified and attending this convention?
Well, certainly. The ones with dots on their badges.
The ones with dots on their badges is what you mean by certified. I just want that on the record.
Mr. Chairman, Roger Peterson.
Roger Peterson, you're recognized.
It seems to me that this amendment in its current form is defective because to make any sense at all, it should say the majority of affiliate votes seated, not of affiliates, plus 25% of the individuals. Because obviously different affiliates have different numbers of votes.
Say that again, please.
It should say where you have of affiliates, it should say of affiliate votes.
Well, the proposer of the amendment, talk.
Otherwise, I'm opposed to it because it doesn't make any sense.
Is the maker of this amendment in the hall? Could you get to a microphone, please? The gentleman's addressed the question, and the chair of the committee would like you to answer it. He is making his way to a microphone.
Mr. Chairman.
Chair recognizes Charlie Hodge.
This is Charlie Hodge from Virginia. This was discussed in the committee, and it was felt that we want to have a representative group on the floor in order to maintain a quorum. It was felt that if it was to say a majority of affiliate votes, you could have California, RSVA, the 25-vote affiliates present and still have a majority of affiliate votes, but only have maybe a quarter of the affiliates present. So this would protect the smaller affiliates by saying a majority of affiliates seated and then at least 25% of individual voting members who are certified to vote at the convention.
I'll take that as a speech in favor of the amendment,
yes,
and
sir.
I'm now calling for speakers against, and I've been approached by two individuals. First, Mr. Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The issue of quorum in this organization has been a thorny one for a number of years. We've developed an approach to trying to measure the quorum that tries to take into account both the number of affiliates present and the number of certified individuals who are currently registered. And by developing a formula that allows us to measure both in a single measurement, we arrive at what seems to me an appropriate measure of quorum. This amendment first creates two measures of quorum. Second, in my view, can be used inappropriately by individuals to end debate. It seems to me, or in fact to end our ability to function, it seems to me that by changing the way that we do quorum in an organization, we're opening ourselves up for the quorum to be used to halt our capacity to perform business while now two computations are done, which have a fair potential of making it impossible for us to complete our business at the convention. I categorically urge the defeat of this amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Speaking in favor of the motion, anybody calling for the floor to speak in favor of the motion?
Mr. Chairman.
I cannot recognize the speaker twice. Charlie. I am now calling for other speakers in favor of the motion. I'll then turn to a speaker against the motion.
Mr. Chairman.
I hear
Robert on the floor, recognize.
Okay. Robert Miller from Florida. I would like to speak against this because the whole purpose of our organization is a democracy, and if we count states by one vote, then that's not very democratic, and it's not fair to the affiliates that pay large amounts of dues. And if you're gonna figure out if you have a quorum, you have to go by the amount of votes that you have on the floor. Thank you.
That was a speaker against. Is there a speaker in favor?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Chair recognizes the lady. Please identify yourself.
Carla Rushville, Kentucky. It would seem to me that the argument for this amendment is the exact one that Mr. Miller used against. Actually, the current amendment requires that a majority of those votes be present to conduct business. It is a lot easier to reach a 25% quorum than a 51% quorum. The number of affiliates present is a very fair measure and is very easy to obtain. We would not, as the president implies, interrupt business for great long periods of time to determine how many affiliates are on this floor. That is a very simple process and is determined every time we call the roll. I would urge that we pass this amendment as it will make it possible for us to continue business at a time when it is highly questionable and has been at many conventions that I have attended, that we are conducting business under the rule in the past. 25% to me ensures that those of us who have spent those great quantities of money to come here are able to continue business rather than using a 51%. Thank you.
I now turn to a speaker against the motion.
Mr. Chair
recognizes Mr. Chairman, Mike Byington.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Point of order.
Yes. Your point?
Yesterday, a couple of days ago, the president stated that we would have 2-4 and 3-4 and 3 against. You this morning stated we would have 2-4 and 2 against. I submit that you have had your 2-4 and 2 against. Therefore, I move we vote.
You're correct, Carla. I thought that this morning I turned to the people at the front desk and said, with all the numbers running through my head, like room numbers for caucuses, I simply didn't remember whether it was 2 or 3, and I asked at the front, and they said it was 2. So I announced 2. You're correct. But I also understand that 3 was what was used yesterday. Is it the will of the people to stick with 2 or go to 3? I'm going to ask one moment, please, ladies and gentlemen. There's an easy way to do this. All those in favor of limiting the debate to 2, say aye.
Aye.
All those against limiting it to 2, say no.
No.
It will be limited to 2. Debate is closed.
Mr. Chairman.
We now move to vote on the motion.
Mr. Chairman.
What does the gentleman call rise?
Rob Hill.
Do you rise to make a motion?
I'd like to move to table this proposal.
A motion has been made to table. Inasmuch as the chair is interpreting the previous vote to limit debate to 2 against and 2-4 as being a motion to call the previous question, it would make a motion to table out of order at this time. And we will proceed to the vote. All of those in favor of the amendment as moved indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
What does it require?
Inasmuch as it requires a 2/3 majority to pass, the chair declares it failed. I'm hearing the word roll call. And inasmuch as I'm hearing the word roll call repeatedly from the floor, I'm going to ask everybody to be seated at this time and ask only those individuals who believe that it is necessary to have a roll call.
Mr. Chairman, a point of order. This is
Mr.
Don
Thompson.
Yes. Is this not a bylaw rather than a constitutional amendment?
Wait a minute. It's a constitutional. It's an article.
It is a constitutional amendment and not a bylaw amendment.
Oh, okay. Then it does require 2/3. I withdraw.
Understood. So now, again, everybody is seated. I'm going to ask those individuals who believe that it is necessary to have a roll call vote on this issue to please stand. 25 individuals, if 25 individuals in the hall, properly certified, stand, then we need to do that. I need a counter. Do we have a counter in the room?
Yes.
We do? Please, those of you who intend to have us do a roll call, remain standing. One moment. Ladies and gentlemen, we do meet the standard. We have more than 25 individuals standing. Therefore, we are going to proceed to a roll call vote. Now, this is actually a record vote and has two components to it. The first component is a standing vote. Only those individuals with name badges with the appropriate little orange dot upon it are allowed to vote. If you've forgotten your badge, my guess is you won't forget it tomorrow. I will now ask all those in favor of passing the amendment that we have been debating to please stand, and all others to sit. If for some reason you do not wish to vote for this at this moment, but must be on your feet, cover your badge with your hand as you move about the hall, so as not to confuse. We'd also ask that you crawl, if at all possible. During this roll call, or during this standing vote, I'm going to ask the chair of the Resolutions Committee to read a resolution. We need to move on with business. We have quite a bit to conduct. Mike, are you ready?
Yes.
Michael's ready. I now turn it over to Michael Byington, chair of our Resolutions Committee.
And I need to take a moment of personal privilege, which I think this circumstance will allow, to explain that in ACB, all resolutions come to the floor. This one took a little bit more of a circuitous route than most. What happens is people give me resolutions on discs and all manners on little scripts of paper, toilet paper, you name it. And I stick them all in my coat pockets. And that evening at the meeting, before it starts, I clean them all out and put them in the computer, either by data entry or sticking them in the slot, depending on what they are written on. Last year, Nelson Melbourne handed me a resolution, and shortly thereafter, I dribbled coffee all down the front of that sports coat. So I hung it in my room, put on another one, and never wore it for the rest of the convention. Therefore, that resolution failed to come out of my coat and jump into the computer. I apologize to Nelson for the delay. He was very gracious about it. But the intent was not to hold up the democratic process, but simply that your resolution, chair, is a slovenly, coffee-swilling, caffeine-addicted dingbat. Whereas, in America, the automobile... Oh, I'm sorry. Move back from the mic. All right. The number is resolution... 0101. I got this one first since I got it last year. Whereas in America, the automobile is the most common mode of transportation, and whereas in many states, vehicle owners are required to carry liability insurance to protect others against loss should accidents occur, and whereas many individuals, including those who are blind or visually impaired, are unable to drive, and whereas some blind and visually impaired individuals own automobiles and arrange for others to drive them, to drive those vehicles. And whereas, despite the requirement to carry liability insurance on an automobile, it is common practice for insurance companies either to refuse to insure vehicles owned by individuals who are blind or visually impaired, or to charge prohibitive rates for coverage. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the American Council of the Blind in convention assembled this 5th day of July, 2001, at the Polk County Convention Center in Des Moines, Iowa, that this organization urge its state affiliates to work with their state insurance commissioners and state legislatures to ensure availability of automobile liability insurance for blind automobile owners at competitive rates. Be it further resolved that this organization direct its staff to assist affiliates in the implementation of this resolution.
Mr. President, the Resolutions Committee moves a do pass.
We have a motion and a second. Do we hear any debate? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The motion is adopted. All of those who have been voting may now be seated. All of those who wish to vote no may now stand. And Mike, let's proceed on to another resolution.
All right, coming up. Here we are.
One moment, hold, Mike. Go ahead, Mike, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay. We'll do it, Bri. This one is resolution. We're into the ones this morning. 0111. Whereas the implementing final regulations under Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 is amended, promulgated by the Architectural and Transportation Barriers Compliance Board, the ATBCB, or Access Board, became effective in June of 2001, and whereas the final implementing regulations promulgated jointly by the Defense Acquisition Regulatory Council, that's DARC, DARC, or the Civilian Agencies Acquisition Council, that's CAAC, CAC, incorporated into the Federal Acquisition Regulations the disability access standards adopted by the Access Board under Section 508. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the American Council of the Blind in convention assembled this 5th day of July, 2001, at the Polk County Convention Center in Des Moines, Iowa, that this organization commend the Access Board DARC and CAC for adopting strong disability access standards, which include rigorous requirements for information access and other technology-based access accommodations for people who are blind or visually impaired. Be it further resolved that this organization call on the Access Board and the United States Department of Justice to engage in aggressive monitoring of the complaint investigation, determination, and enforcement processes required of the various federal procuring agencies affected by the new 508 regulations. Mr. President, the Resolutions Committee recommends a do pass.
Second.
Motion made and seconded. Do I hear any debate? Hearing none, all of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The motion's adopted. Michael, I'm going to ask you to pause for one moment. And Kathy, are you prepared to do the reading? This is the first reading of an additional amendment. We will not be voting on this amendment, but we need to get it into the record. Kathy, are you prepared to do that?
Yes. This is our last amendment. And this... Remember, ladies and gentlemen, you are the ones who present most of these amendments to us. And the majority will rule, but the minority should be heard. Courteously? This is one that you sent back to us last year. It told us from last year to reconsider this year. So we have reworked it. It's on page 27. Amend bylaw 2A by striking out the second through sixth sentences and inserting the following. An affiliate shall verify that the list is current as to names, addresses, and preferred Braille forum format for all voting members of the affiliate, including ACB Life members, for whom no payment of annual per capita dues is required. This verification shall be noted on the printout itself. The affiliate shall deposit the current membership information accompanied by its annual dues in the United States mail, postage prepaid, and address to the National Office on or before March 15th. Compliance with this provision has occurred if supported by evidence satisfactory to the Credentials Committee. The number of votes which an affiliate is entitled to cast at the convention shall be computed based on the March 15th membership information and dues mailed as specified above. If the March 15th membership information and dues mailed disagree as to the number of affiliate voting members, the lower number shall be used, provided that the lower number reflects the inclusion of that affiliate's ACB life members. An affiliate may amend its March member voting information at any time during the year and shall remit dues as appropriate to allow new member individual votes at the convention. That's new member individual votes at the convention. If an affiliate makes no changes in its March list for three consecutive years, the board of directors, the board of directors shall ask for a complete recertification of the affiliate's voting members. If an affiliate fails to comply with this section, the first year of noncompliance may result in diminished voting privileges, and the second consecutive year of noncompliance may result in revocation of the affiliate's charter. Now, I didn't go ahead and add the part that we passed today because we hadn't passed it today. So this is just to do with the second part. Now, what we would be cutting out would be the current wording: the affiliate shall verify the list and make appropriate additions, deletions, and or corrections. The affiliate shall verify the list and make appropriate additions, deletions, and corrections if there are any deletions or modifications. That fact shall be noted on the printout. The affiliate shall deposit the updated membership list accompanied by its annual dues in the United States Post Office, postage prepaid and addressed to the National Office on or before March 15th. Compliance with this provision has occurred if supported by evidence satisfactory to the Credentials Committee. An affiliate may amend its voting membership list at any time by adding, deleting, or correcting names and street addresses, but the number of votes which an affiliate is entitled to cast at a convention shall be computed based on the updated membership information and dues mailed as specified above. The updated membership information and dues mailed disagree as to the number of affiliate voting members, the lower number shall be used. Okay. The finished product.
One moment. All you folks standing, you can sit now. Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt in the middle of that and cause confusion. Kathy, go ahead.
Okay, the final product then that we would have would be: the affiliate shall verify that the list is current as to names, addresses, and preferred Braille forum format for all voting members of the affiliate, including life members for whom no payment of per capita dues is required. This verification shall be noted on the printout itself. The affiliate shall deposit the current membership information accompanied by its annual dues in the United States mail, postage prepaid and addressed to the National Office on or before March 15th. Compliance with this provision has occurred if supported by evidence satisfactory to the Credentials Committee. The number of votes which an affiliate is entitled to cast at the convention shall be computed based on the March 15th membership information and dues mailed as specified above. If the March 15th membership information and dues mailed disagree to the number of affiliate voting members, the lower number shall be used, provided that the lower number reflects the inclusion of that affiliate's ACB Life members. An affiliate may amend its March 15th membership information at any time during the year and shall remit dues as appropriate to allow new member individual votes at the convention. Okay, that is all that I have to read, but the committee has a recommendation, a procedural recommendation that I want to read to you, please. The committee recommends, and this is a motion from the committee. The Constitution and Bylaw Committee recommends that the committee, when updating the 2001 Constitution and bylaws, be authorized to make clerical corrections, such as renumbering or relettering and changes in punctuation without recourse to formal amendments.
Thank you, Kathy.
Mr. Chairman, Pat Beattie, Alexandria, Virginia.
Yes.
Point of information.
Yes.
I think that's what this is. Does the Constitution somewhere assign life members to an affiliate?
It isn't that. It's that your life members are included in your count.
Whose life members?
I think it does. From each affiliate. Well,
you're a life member of American Council of the Blind, I thought, not of an affiliate.
But
I believe that this might be taking on the timber of a debate. So what I suggest that you do, Pat, is meet with the chair and discuss that issue and be prepared to during debate tomorrow.
Okay, that'll be fine. My room's 2418, Pat.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, the time has come for the second part of a record vote. That is the roll call component. Because of the unusual nature of the special interest affiliate seating this morning, it may be difficult or have been difficult for you as members sitting in your state delegations to find your special interest delegate to indicate to them how you would like them to cast your special interest affiliate votes. For this reason, we invite any special interest affiliate delegates during the call of the states to be up here in the front so that people who wish to reach you can come up to the front and will assist people in finding the appropriate person. This is the only thing we can come up with that will allow you to be located under these unusual circumstances. Any special interest affiliate delegates who wish to be located by their members can come up to the front of the hall and stand against the front here of the section. You will be called as appropriate, but this is the best way we can come up with to deal with these circumstances. Right where you are, that's correct. All right. And you all folks know how to find them now. They're up front and center as well. Now, let me turn it over to the secretary to call the roll. I would ask... I would ask that you states get in line early because we have to get this through. And remember, we still have breakout sessions to go off to. So, we need to turn on the secretary's mic, please, Jay.
Got it. Go ahead.
Go, Cynthia.
today as well as tomorrow. What I'm going to be doing is calling the shortened version of your state. So please don't get upset if I don't call the whole thing. This is in the interest of time.
Cynthia, all six microphones on the floor are on, so the three in the back of the room are available, so you people can line up there as well.
Also, too, those of you, I want to get this over with for today as well as tomorrow. Please make sure those of you who are reporting your numbers, that they add up to the number of votes that your state affiliate gets. Alabama, 8.
Alabama cast 8 in favor of the amendment.
8, yes. Alaska, 20. Oh, excuse me. Those of you coming up here, can you please do it as quietly as possible? I know that's kind of difficult, but I need to get an accurate vote count. Thank you. Alaska, 20.
Alaska, 20, no.
20, no. Arizona, 8.
Arizona, 2, yes. 6, no.
2, yes. 6, no. Arkansas, 5.
Arkansas, 5, no.
5, no. California, 25.
California, 25, no.
25, no. Colorado, 6.
Colorado, 6, no.
6, no. Connecticut, 2. Yes or no? 2, yes. You got to tell me which one. I'm not going to make that decision for you. Delaware, 1.
Delaware, 1, yes.
1, yes. D.C., 3.
District of Columbia, 2, yes, 1, no.
2, yes, 1, no. Florida, 25.
Florida, 25, no.
25, no. Georgia, 11. Again, those of you up front, could you please, please, the teacher's asking you, or I'm calling your parents. Please keep the talking down.
Georgia votes 7 yes,
all right.
4 no.
All right, okay. All right. Georgia, 11.
Georgia votes 7 yes, 4 no.
7 yes, 4 no. Hawaii, 2.
Hawaii votes 2 yes.
2 yes. Idaho, 3/4. Moving on. Illinois, 12.
Illinois, 5 yes, 7 no.
5 yes, 7 no. Indiana, 10.
Indiana, 10 yes.
10 yes. Iowa, 7.
Iowa, 7 yes.
7 yes. Kansas, 12.
Kansas, 12 no.
12 no. Kentucky, 12.
Kentucky, 12 yes.
12 yes. Bluegrass, 3.
Bluegrass, 3 yes.
3, yes. Louisiana, 3.
Louisiana, 3, no.
3, no. Maine, 1.5. Moving on. Maryland, 6.
Maryland, 2.5, yes. 3.5, no.
2.5, yes. 3.5, no. Bay State, 15.
Bay State, 15, no.
15, no. Michigan, 10.
Hang on a second. New York.
Can you hear me?
Michigan?
Just a minute. Okay. Michigan, 5 yes, 5 no.
5 yes, 5 no. Minnesota, 4.
Minnesota, 1 yes, 3 no.
1 yes, 3 no. Mississippi, 11.
Mississippi, 11 yes.
11 yes. Missouri, 25. Missouri.
Missouri. 25, yes.
25, yes. Nebraska, 2.
Getting up here, I apologize. Okay, thank you. Nebraska, 2, no.
2, no. Nevada, 5.
Nevada, 5, yes.
5, yes. New Jersey, 5. New Jersey? Moving on. New Mexico, 1.
New Mexico, 1, no.
1, no. New York, 12.
New York, 11 yes, 1 no.
11 yes, 1 no. North Carolina, 10. North Carolina? Moving on, North Dakota, 7.
North Dakota, 7, yes.
7, yes. Ohio, 12.
Ohio's coming.
He's coming. He's right here. Here he is, right there.
Ohio, 7, no, and 5, yes.
5, yes, 7, no. Oklahoma, 25.
Oklahoma, 25, no.
25, no. Oregon, 11.
3, yes, 8, no.
3, yes, 8, no. Pennsylvania, 25.
Pennsylvania, 25, no.
25, no. South Carolina, 3.
South Carolina, 3, no.
3, no. South Dakota, 8.
South Dakota, 8, no.
8, no. Tennessee, 8.
Tennessee, 8, yes.
8, yes. Texas, 12.
5, yes. 7, no.
5, yes. 7, no. Utah, 21.
19, yes. 1, no. No, sorry. I've got it backwards. Sorry, don't record that. 19, no. 1, yes. 2 abstentions. No, 1 abstention. 2 abstentions.
19, yes. 1, no. 1 abstention. Vermont, 2. Utah
is 19, no.
19, no.
1, yes.
1, yes.
1 abstention.
1 abstention. Thank you. Vermont, 2. Moving on. Old Dominion, 4.
Old Dominion, 1, yes. 3, no.
1, yes. 3, no. Virginia, 25.
Virginia Association of the Blind. Unit rules, 25, no.
25, no. Washington, 10.
Washington votes 9 yes, 1 no.
9 yes, 1 no. Badger, 25.
Badger Association votes 25 no.
25 no. Wyoming, 1. Moving on to the special interest affiliates, Alliance on Aging, 5.
AAVL votes 1 yes, 4 no.
1 yes, 4 no. Government employees, 2.
Government employees, 1.5 yes, 1.5 no.
1.5 yes, 0.5 no. Radio amateurs, 2.
How many you say, 2?
Yes, I did.
Okay. I hate to do this. 1/4 yes and the rest no.
You figure it out.
1/4. We got it. Blind lawyers, 5.
5, no.
5, no. Lions, 12.
Lions vote 12, no.
B-flag, 2.
B-flag, 2, no.
2, no. Braille Revival League, 13.
Braille Revival League, 13, yes.
13, yes. Council of Citizens with Low Vision, 12.
Somebody need to get past me. Go ahead.
Council of Citizens with Low Vision, 10, yes, 2, no.
10, yes. Barbara, that's reversed, I'm hearing.
Okay, that's reversed.
May I have your vote, please?
2 no, 10 yes.
2
or is that
no.
Still reversed.
Yes.
Here, can you do it?
How many yeses?
I came up to vote.
2 yeses.
2 yes.
10
no. Families, 4. Moving on.
No. 2 no.
But you have 4, though.
4 no.
Four, no. Friends in Art, 4.
Friends in Art, I'm sorry, 4?
Yes.
Okay. Friends in Art,
4 no.
4 no. Guide dog users, 25.
5 yes, 20 no.
5 yes, 20 no. Enterprisers, 4.
Ivy votes 3 yes, 1 no.
3 yes, 1 no. Library users, 4.
One no, three yes for library users.
One yes, three no. Students, 7.
I'm sorry. That's not Jess? Right. One no, three yes.
What? One no, three yes. Students, 7.
Students, 7 no.
7 no. Teachers, 3.
Teachers, 2 yes, 1 no.
2 yes, 1 no. Vendors, 25.
That's RSVA you're asking for?
Yes.
RSVA votes 25 no.
25 no. Data processors, 3.
Okay, data processors, 2.5 yes, 0.5 no.
2.5 yes, 0.5 no. Let me see. Veterans, 2.
Viva, 1 yes, 1 no.
1 yes, 1 no. Mr. President, that completes the roll.
I'm going to call on Jim Olson to announce the vote.
The yes total is 334.75. The no vote is, get my magnifier here, is 565.25. The percentage no is 62.81%.
So the motion fails. And I want to suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that when the chair announced that the motion had originally failed because it didn't reach the two-thirds majority, you could hear up here that this was very clearly not even close. This did not even meet the requirement of a 50%, let alone a two-thirds majority, and it has eaten up approximately 30 minutes to accomplish. While that is acceptable behavior, I want you to simply know that from the podium up here, it is much easier to tell this than it is out there. I've sat out there for years, and I know that everybody around me voted the same way, and I heard my own voice. Yes, Carla, to what point do you rise?
Mr. Chairman, a point of order. I think it is inappropriate for the chair to reprimand an organization which he says is democratic.
That's not the thing to be doing, sir.
Carla, my friend, I want you to understand that I was not reprimanding the organization. I was May I have order?
Mr. Chairman.
May I have order?
Mr. Chairman.
Carla, to what do you rise?
To respond to your statement to me, to which I have the right to do. It is inappropriate that this assembly be reprimanded for expressing the view of either the majority or the minority. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It was not the intent of the chair to in any way do this, and I apologize if it was interpreted by some that that was in fact what was going on. It was an attempt to explain, not to chastise. Tempers are going to get very hot during the course of this convention, ladies and gentlemen. Keep in mind that it is nobody's intent, either from the podium or from the floor, to be disrespectful to anybody. And I apologize if that's the way it came across. It was not, please believe me, my intention. I would now ask, I want to make a couple of brief room change announcements. ACB GE's 2 o'clock meeting has been moved. It will be in this hall at the front of the room. Secondly, the fiber arts seminar will now be in room at 2 o'clock will now be in room 143. 143 at 2 o'clock. Is Jim ready for life? Jim, are you ready for life? Jim, are you ready for life, member?
Sure.
Now let's turn to something more positive, shall we?
Mr. Chairman.
Hold on one moment. We are going to now do life members. There were a couple that didn't get a chance to come on earlier, and I really do think that we owe them our respect as we bring on to ACB some additional life members. And I turn the microphone over to Jim Olson, our CFO of ACB.
Okay. The Virginia Association of the Blind has pledged $5,000 to ACB at the time of our budgeting process, and they have decided that with that $5,000 they wish to recognize five of their members for life membership. And I'll read their names, and we're asking them to come forward, and we will assemble them down here on the floor. Paul, if you might. Paul's going down there. I need to apologize. I told Nelson Melbourne that we would do this on Friday. Nelson is having dialysis this morning. My apologies, Alice, to Nelson and to the rest of you in Virginia Association. I forgot that tonight at 6 o'clock in the presidential suite, there is a reception held for the life members. We moved it from Friday to Thursday, so I wanted to take and recognize these people for their life membership today. The first person we're recognizing is Terry Hepler. He's their corresponding secretary and is also bookkeeper for their bingo operations. Terry is also their grant writer, van driver, sighted guide, and is available for anything at any time that they ask him. Now, Terry may not be here because Terry was the driver for Nelson this morning, but we want to recognize Terry. We will see that he does receive his life. Is he back? She. Excuse me.
You've got to be careful about that. You must make assumptions.
Oh, yes, and I see it is a she on here because that's the way it's written. Okay. The next person, unfortunately, is ill this morning and also, and that's Ezekiel Hymanet, is always there to make phone calls and help arrange van transportation for their organization and other individuals to attend various events. Third person should be here, Christine Kutchkins.
Hi, Christine. Congratulations.
First Vice President of the Virginia Association of the Blind. Paul?
Christine, congratulations. I'm very excited here. That's wonderful. And there's your plaque.
Thank you.
So you get to come for every convention now. Would you like to?
I enjoyed every one of them. It's my second one.
Excellent. Would you like to say anything?
Oh, no. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, the next person is Ron Hepler. Ron is in charge of their food share program and also in charge of their van deliveries. Is Ron here? I think so, yes.
Hey, Ron, how are you? It's good to see you. You want to say anything?
I'd like to tell my appreciation to Virginia Association of the Blind. Even though I'm a sighted person, I've always... and my wife have always worked with my mom and stepdad are both blind, and we enjoy it.
And I got to tell you, Ron and Terry do wonderful work for the Virginia Association. And both Terry and Ron also have been just wonderful folks in terms of sharing the information they get with other folks within ACB. Terry is a huge good source for the availability of grants. So any of you guys interested in writing grants, get hold of Terry. She'll help you.
Yes. And the last person that is present here this morning is Dave Benjamin. Dave is a newcomer to their organization, an up-and-coming board member, and he also works very close with his business associates in obtaining support for the Virginia Association of the Blind.
Excellent. Congratulations, Dave, and I recognize you for a few words if you want to say them.
Thank you very much. This is some surprise. The Virginia Association of the Blind has bought something very close to my heart, and so is this convention right here. Thank you all.
Congratulations, Dave.
Thank you all. The other night, those of you that did receive your life memberships, you may not have received the invitation letter in time, but the reception is this evening in the presidential suite. It's in your program agenda. This now brings to 154 the life memberships that we now have. Justin Dart was our first back at the Knoxville Convention.
That is a lot of life members. That's going to be one crowded reception, Mr. President. I hope you've got plenty of room for them. Ladies and gentlemen, it is now my privilege to bring to the podium our immediate past president, Mr. Leroy Saunders, who I had the privilege of working with on the board for a number of years as his treasurer. He's an amazing individual. Anybody who's been going back and forth across these sky bridges knows you're oftentimes going to see Leroy doing it. I don't know how he finds the time to do it all. He's our convention coordinator, our immediate past president, and he's going to share with you today some of his reflections during his tenure as president. Please join me in welcoming him to the podium. Leroy Saunders.
Good morning. Now, I know that I'm standing between you and a break, so I will not take too long. I was going to speak an hour, but I guess we'll do it in about 10 minutes. First, I need to make a couple announcements. Our drivers for the carts all say they cannot work past 5 p.m. today. So the people who need to ride the carts back this afternoon, we need to get you moving at least by 4:30, so hopefully we can get everybody back that needs to be back by 5 o'clock. Our drivers have agreed to work late tomorrow night, so about 30 minutes or so before our reception, before the banquet tomorrow night, we will be picking people up, and they will stay and carry people back after the banquet. We've been very fortunate to have the drivers to operate these carts, so they've just done a great job. Also, the convention office tomorrow will close about 9 a.m. since all of our people that work in there want to be up here for the officers' elections. Now, I want you to understand before I start talking that nobody makes things happen and accomplish a great deal without other people helping. And a lot of times it's impossible to really recognize all the people that assisted you. But I want you to know as I go through a few of the things that I think was accomplished during my 6 years, that it took a good board who was willing to support me and give me the opportunity to do some things. It took an excellent staff in the Washington office. It took many people who served on committees, and I can tell you it was over 100, to also help get our job done. So after saying that, I'd just like to go through very quickly some of the things that I feel like contributed to this organization. First, I want to tell you about me becoming president. President of this organization was not on my agenda. I'm a person who prefers really to work behind the scene, not necessarily out in front. And I was shocked when Otis Stevens called me and said, "Leroy, I'm not going to run for another term because of various reasons, and I want you to run for president." I said, "Otis, I don't want that job." He said, "Yeah," but he said, I think you'd do a good job." Well, the next thing I knew, a few other people started to encourage me. So consequently, throw my hat in the ring. Also, I was, I think, and and some of you people here longer than I can correct me if I'm wrong, that I was the first low-vision person to be president of this organization. And I can tell you that there were some people out there who didn't think, who did think I saw too well to be president, but I told them the job didn't pay enough for me to put on blindfolds and work. The ironic part of that is, and again, this is because I had resources at my disposal that presidents before me probably didn't have. I was also, I think, the first person that started sending out Braille in large print to everybody that I corresponded with, and of course later added cassette discs and also tape recordings. The first thing I had to do as president was to find a new editor. Murray Ballard had decided to stop being our editor, and at that time Chris Gray was chair of the BOP, and we had a search committee made up of Chris and Paul Edwards and myself. And of course y'all knew that we did hire Nolan Crabb, and that was, I think, in January or February after I became president. Money was short at that time, so that held back a lot of things. But I did gradually start getting the office computerized. We did have a Romeo, and I bought got a Juliet to offset that. So the office began to send more things out in Braille and large print. Later on, because money became available, I could get more professional staff hired in the office, and two people in particular that I think really did an excellent job for us was Paul Schrader and Judy Carroll. I can tell you one of my proudest moments is not only being president, but being a member of ACB. And if my memory is correct, it was the celebration of the first year of the ADA. And I was standing out there on the lawn in front of the White House, and they were introducing the people that were up at the podium and who the dignitaries, I guess you'd say, that were there. And, of course, they were cabinet people. And out of a clear blue sky that I didn't know about, and I don't think many, if any, did, they introduced Paul Schrader. And that's kind of getting up with high cotton when you can stand up there with those folks and be introduced as a representative of ACB. I was able to, I guess you'd say, reinstitute the president's meetings. That had gone on earlier, and again, because of short funds, it was discontinued. And I had the first meeting in Oklahoma City, and I did something, I think, a little different. I got our database, and I searched out how many people received the Braille Forum in each state. And then, of course, I had the membership of each state. So I let these people know that they weren't doing a good job getting members, because we had a hell of a lot more Braille Forum going out than we had members. One of the things that was suggested, and I think one of the first persons that suggested to me, was Steve Spiker. He said, you know, we really need to have a long-range plan, or at least sit down and do some strategy work to kind of put this organization in a position to where it kind of knows where it's headed. I went to the board of directors. I got authorization to do that. had quotes from different consultants that do this, and hired a person by the name of Bob Barrett. It took us a couple years, and I put together what I think was a cross-section of this organization, nine people. If you can do it with nine people, and I think I pretty much was successful at that. And we reported constantly to the board of directors. And our final draft was presented to the board of directors before we presented one for actual approval so that they could have input, and that input we could capture and make changes accordingly. And in Greensboro, North Carolina, this was accepted, and this is when we became, we had an organization then that had an executive director. We followed that plan to a great extent, not quite as much as I would have liked to, but anyway, it's been there and it sure has helped us. Also, we put together a history committee and hired Jim McGiven, who's here. And I'd like to tell Paul I wasn't sure I was going to live long enough to read the history, but I was so pleased when I heard that we had signed a contract. I was fortunate in that I could make a couple trips to foreign countries, and Ora Miller is the one who really got these set up. We went to Japan, we went to Russia, and we went to Germany. And, folks, if I hadn't been president of this organization, I probably wouldn't have had the opportunity to do this. I, too, worked with the World Blind Union. And during the time I was, well, actually just before Otis left his position as president, the Dr. Jernigan set up a group of people called JOE, Joint Organization Effort. And when Otis reviewed this with the board, they just at that point would not let us become involved in that organization, and I'm not going into all the reasons. But eventually, they did allow me to represent us at those meetings, and Otis also was a person who went with me. And I think the real outcome of that was that Otis and I think were able to encourage other people as members of the North American Caribbean section of the World Blind Union that ACB was a very viable organization. And believe it or not, and it really shocked one person in particular, we even won a few votes in that organization. Ladies and gentlemen, let me just say to you that I personally thoroughly enjoyed being president of this organization. I felt like my main expertise was in administration, and I tried to use that to make some things happen that hadn't happened before. And without all of the help that I got, and the biggest thing I enjoyed was the people. I was able to go around. There's not many people that can go about any size city in this country and know somebody there. Also, I didn't like running the meetings, so I let the officers do it. And I don't know that I was the first one that did that or not. But while they were doing that, I was out talking to people. But that's what I thoroughly enjoyed to do. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. And it was a pleasure being president of this organization.
Mr. Brown, thank you very much, Leroy.
Leroy used the phrase standing in tall cotton. And that's what I felt every time I stood next to Leroy Saunders. He certainly defines tall cotton. A few announcements before we break. I understand we want door prizes. We'll get there. Give me a moment. Got to get all this in. There will be a quick line for bag lunches in the quick meals area. And those of you going on the Bridges of Madison County tour will need to slip by there to pick up yours. I don't think this is included in the bill, but I'm not going on that tour. Next, Old Dominion Council will be holding its caucus at noon today in room 204A. 204A. Florida will be holding its caucus today at noon in room 204B. Bay State Council of the Blind will be holding its caucus at noon in 205J. And let's see here. Women's Concerns will have a focus on fitness at 3 p.m. in room number 140. Lastly, AIB, Are You Congenitally Blind, will be meeting today at 3:30 in room number 142. Now that I've confused you with all those room numbers, we need to first... I wish I could win a door prize. Let's try a door prize right now.
We have a hat and a T-shirt from Mid-Tennessee for Paul Miller from Veneta, Oklahoma. Not.
He's here.
Is he here?
Bye, Brian.
See you later.
Next. We have one more door prize. Let's do it.
How about $50 from the Pennsylvania Council?
$50. We can all use that.
David Lance, Des Moines, Iowa. Not here.
Not here.
Karen Gogarty, New York.
Yay, we got a winner. I heard a number of calls from the floor. Are they in the nature of announcements?
Yeah.
I believe it's Ed Bradley to my left. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Doctor?
Microphone. Okay, thank you. I want to make the announcement that Leroy Saunders asked me yesterday if I had any information about next year's hotel. I have about 500 sheets of information on how to pre-register, and I can leave that at the information desk or up front here, whichever the chair prefers I do that. But I don't have enough for everybody, but I do have about 500 copies. Thank you.
You could leave those at the information desk. That would be really helpful. Thank you. Now, we need to discuss where we're going. One moment. Paul dodged out of the room to find out what's going on and left me without the list of which room's which. Hold on a second. Jay has the list of room numbers.
Thank you, Brian. Just come up from those rooms. And Paul took the list with him. So the PAM session on counseling is in 142 to 144. That will be on the right as you go down there. On the left side, 137 to 140 is the DVS. And in this room is the pedestrian safety / ATM. Brian, that's the story.
Very good. We are now going to adjourn on break. Find your way to those breakout sessions. They're supposed to begin as promptly as possible at 10:30. Thank you very much. We're in recess.
First Vice President Brian Charlson presiding over that general session, which consisted of business, including a constitutional amendment, which saw the first roll call of this convention. You're listening to live coverage of ACB's 40th annual convention, coming to you from the Polk County Convention Complex in Des Moines, Iowa. I'm Jonathan Mosen, and thank you for listening around the world, and thank you for continuing to send in the emails. the roll call folks certainly generated a few, and I've tried to answer those as they've come in, tapping away here on the keyboard. We certainly appreciate the contact. You can get in touch with us at any time during the convention, or perhaps if you're listening on demand, feel free to email us and we'll get that as soon as we come back into the complex. The email address is convention@acbradio.org. That's convention@acbradio.org. There are three concurrent sessions going on in the next part of the proceedings. The one that we are streaming is called Getting to the ATM Safely. That encompasses automatic teller machine access, there's been a bit of movement on that of late, and pedestrian safety. Speaking about pedestrian safety will be Julie Carroll of Virginia, and speaking about accessible ATMs is Lainey Fingold of California. So that will be taking place after the break, I suspect sooner rather than later. I think it's unlikely we'll get a full 15-minute break. There are other things to tell you about. At midday, we will, as is the custom, go into a replay of this morning's proceedings. But we will be back live again at 2 p.m. At that time, ACBGE, that's the ACB Governmental Employees, will be holding a couple of seminars that I know will be of interest to many ACB radio listeners. The first one, I believe it's in this order, looks at the 70% job unemployment rate among blind Americans and asks the question, why is that? We have lots of technology out there now. Theoretically, we have access to more vocational options than ever before. And yet we don't seem to be able to make a dent in the unemployment statistics. So there'll be some interesting discussion going on there. Also, an update on Section 508 of the Rehab Act. And, of course, the whole reauthorization of the Rehab Act will probably come up for discussion as well. And we'll be broadcasting those two proceedings here on ACB Radio Mainstream Live. Now, I did say this at the beginning of the program, but I noticed that we've had a significant listenership increase since then, and I have had emails asking this. We are unable to stream the candidates forum. The reason for that is that we don't have access to the convention complex this evening. ACB has negotiated the days that we can have it with the people who own the convention complex, and so we are having to do the candidates forum in the Marriott, and we can't stream from there, so that will not be broadcast live. But of course we will be giving you complete coverage tomorrow of the ACB elections, where there will be elections for a new president, first and second vice presidents, secretary and treasurer. And if you want to get a feel for the candidates and you're at home, don't forget that the debates, which were run in accordance with rules established by the American Council of the Blind's Board of Publications, are still available to you in the on-demand section of ACB Radio. You can visit www.acbradio.org, go into the on-demand section, and I think the first link there is the 2001 debates, pre-election debates. There's a good few hours of listening there that you can hear. So while we are unable to do the candidates forum, and we would like to have, we hope that at least our internet audience has had an opportunity to quiz the candidates. Tomorrow is banquet day, or more specifically, tomorrow evening is banquet night, and ACB Radio will be there, and in fact doing the banquet entertainment this year. I have to tell you that we are going to have some fun. And I'm not going to say any more than that, except that there is a significant announcement from ACB Radio Interactive tomorrow night, and I think you'll want to hear that, as well as the other entertainment that we have planned for you and the convention attendees tomorrow night here from Des Moines. On Saturday, there's the final general session, so everybody sort of struggles up at 8 in the morning, and we will be here for that. There is a large number of resolutions to go through, and Saturday is the day where a lot of that kind of business is conducted. once all of that business is complete, then the convention adjourns, and that will be the conclusion of ACB Radio's coverage from Des Moines. Yeah, it's sort of amazing to think, after all the planning and everything that's gone into it, that we've only got about 48 hours of coverage left to run, but there is lots of action between now and then, and you'll hear it as it takes place on ACB Radio Mainstream. A reminder that if you want to get in touch, the email address is convention@acbradio.org. That's convention@acbradio.org, and we're always interested in receiving your feedback. In fact, I think that we have some email coming. Oh, we've got quite a lot of email, actually. Yeah, I don't think I'm... Okay, I'm going to have to sift through some of this email. But anyway, we'll get there. We'll answer any queries that you have when we come back after the break. We're about, I think, to get involved with to begin our general session coverage, which, of course, is the breakout, which is covering the subject of getting to the ATM on time. Getting to the ATM safely. Sounds like something out of My Fair Lady, didn't it? Was it My Fair Lady that song comes from? I'm Getting Married in the Morning. Yeah, it was. Sure it was. Just trying to think of the guy's name. Stanley Holloway, that's who it was. Yeah, very good indeed. Now, on ACB Radio, on our other channels, of course, if you need a break from the tension that is starting to build as we head towards the big day tomorrow, well, you can tune into ACB Radio Interactive. The team there has been running, gosh, for nearly a week continuously. They went to some considerable effort to provide you with additional coverage this week, not only from the convention, but also from various places around the world. In fact, in six countries, ACB Radio Interactive has broadcasters. So there's music there. There's also entertainment on ACB Radio Treasure Trove with a whole range of old-time radio and comedy. And the ACB Radio Cafe showcases the music of blind musicians. So those are the other channels on ACB Radio at www.acbradio.org. And if you're listening to this on a radio information service, well, we certainly urge you to, if you're getting larger all the time, but we do our best to make it accessible and easy for you to find what it is that you're looking for. There's also a search engine there if you'd like to avail yourself of that. There are other meetings that are taking place this afternoon here at the convention. I think things are starting to kind of wind down, and a lot of caucuses have already taken place. There are a few left. And one of the really nice features to be included, or hopefully merged into the few questions that can be asked, because there's a record number of people wanting to ask questions this year, apparently, there are items for sale. People advertise. For example, I see that there are some really interesting T-shirts that you can get, that one of the affiliates who's seeking to raise money have done in an enterprising attempt to part us with our dollars. You can get a T-shirt with the phrase "designated driver" on it, and that's in Braille and print, which I think is quite clever. And you can get another T-shirt that has a picture of a pair of hands on it, and it says "Try seeing things my way," and a few other mugs as well. And all of that is advertised in the paper, which has a new name every year, the name to reflect in some way the venue of the convention. This year, the newspaper is called the Corn Silk Sentinel. It's produced by volunteers and overseen, of course, by Penny Reader, who is the editor of ACB's official publication, the Braille Forum. And when you go into the press room, which this year is in the Marriott, it's just a hive of activity in there at all hours of the day and night. And they're working on computers, and printers are printing, and it's just an amazing atmosphere. And they churn out this newspaper, this informative publication, every morning. Another way in which ACB seeks to inform attendees of the convention about current events is a newsline telephone service. This is a recorded system. You dial in, and it's running on an extension at the Marriott, but they also have a way of communicating with it outside, because there are several hotels that are being used for the convention this year. And you get information, it's updated twice daily, about what's happening. So I think, well, the the compere is just urging people to kind of come together a little bit, because we're in the large general session room and we've now spread up into three groups. I understand that the largest attendance is taking place in the workshop that Pam Shaw is doing. Now, Pam is ACB's second vice president, and she's doing a workshop on communicating without stress, something that all of us in the advocacy business need to think about. And Pam is a qualified psychologist, I'm pretty sure that's correct, and she's now practicing independently. She set up her own business. And so that's attracted a lot of attendance, but the decision has been made that what we want to stream is the information on accessible ATMs and pedestrian safety, both things that ACB have channeled a lot of advocacy resources and time into in recent years. At the Marriott for the last week, there has been an automatic teller machine available all the time. It's not a demo. It's there. It's working. And this has been supplied by the Bank of America. I put my Visa card in it the other day, and it works. You plug a set of headphones in, and a very clear set of instructions guides you through the process of getting the funds and perhaps obtaining an account balance, etc. So that's all very well and good, but of course, if you're having difficulty in getting to the ATM because of very busy streets and inaccessible crossings, then that rather defeats the purpose. And that's why it's been deemed appropriate to group these two topics together in this presentation, which we're about to hear, getting to the ATM safely. So that's coming up in just a moment here on ACB Radio Mainstream. And while I have this opportunity to tell you, don't forget that if you are a modem user and you would like to support ACB Radio, there is a way in which you can do that. You may have heard Charlie Crawford talking about this yesterday. We have an agreement with Easy Access USA, which actually is the ISP I have been using while I've been here. And if you want to donate $4 a month to ACB Radio and also get nationwide US internet access at 56K with a couple of email accounts for $19.95 a month, you can do all of that by visiting the website at www.easyaccessusa.net. Let's go to the entertainment, to the proceedings, if I can do that. Here we go.
Yeah, these are just all pet safety handbooks.
Right. Okay. It's my understanding, just in different formats.
Thank you. I need some water.
We're not quite ready yet, and let me tell you that tomorrow morning, if you tune in early, just after 8 central, we hope, barring any last-minute issues that the President needs to deal with on such an important day, that Paul Edwards can give us a short amount of time to talk us through the way in which the elections are going to be conducted for the offices of the American Council of the Blind. So if you're listening internationally, or perhaps you're not a member of ACB, you've never attended a national convention, and you want to fully understand what's going on as it goes on, because I don't want to interrupt proceedings with narration, then what we hope to do is to have Paul talk us through that at around about 8:15 tomorrow morning, if that's possible. So tune in early tomorrow and get a feel for how things are going to be conducted tomorrow. But I can tell you that essentially what happens is that there will be 5 minutes where each candidate nominated for a position can select speakers. The custom is to use two speakers more often than not, but they don't have to use two. They can use their 5 minutes to have as many speakers as they wish speak in favour of their nomination. And it's not the custom, unlike perhaps organisations outside of the US, to have the nominee speak at a time like this. They generally have people who speak for them and extol their virtues as they are perceived to be. And then, of course, there is a vote for the position after people have had their speakers speak, and that vote will take place, as you heard the roll call this morning, on the constitutional amendment. So there will be an affiliate vote where the states are called, and then the special interest affiliates, and also a standing vote where individuals are entitled to stand. Those who are members of ACB and entitled to vote, they stand first for, and then for the different candidates, and the votes are tallied. So that's how things will run tomorrow, and Paul will talk us through all of those issues tomorrow morning, hopefully at around about 8:15 here on ACB Radio Mainstream. We're just about ready to proceed now. People are settling down towards the front of the room, and I hear some throat clearing. Here we go.
Thank you for coming to our session on pedestrian access and ATM access. We're going to talk a little bit about pedestrian access first, and then go into, once we've figured out how to get there safely, talk about ATM access. And Lainey Feingold is here with me today. Show of hands, applause rather. How many of you have accessible signals in your community? That is amazing. Wow. Great. Yeah, need more. That's right. Let me give you an update, first of all, where we are in terms of our regulations and federal standards on accessible pedestrian signals. We have made a lot of progress, and I want to make sure people are aware of what is required so that when you're working in your communities to get signals installed, you get the right kind installed. There's not a lot of information out for traffic engineers and cities and other municipalities to help them know. This is all very, very new to them. So you might be the one who has to bring all this information to the table. And I hope you're finding those tables where these issues are being discussed and negotiated, and making sure that people from ACB are represented. Let me just run down the list of some of the things that are now part of the federal recommendations for accessible pedestrian signals. First, let me tell you, there are two documents that you will need to have if you negotiate with your traffic engineers or municipalities. The first is the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, MUTCD, it's called. That is the federal standard for all signals in the United States. Traffic engineers all use basically one standard for signaling technology. And as you no doubt know, that was recently updated and incorporated some of the requests that we made for standards for accessible signals. So we've come a long way. But because it is very new, if your traffic engineer, municipality, people may not know about it. So it's up on the ACB website, I believe. And please try and get familiar with it. The second document that you need to be familiar with is the Public Rights of Way Advisory Committee report. That was published in January of this year and is on the website of the Access Board, which is www.access-board.gov. And all of their documents are available in just about any format you want if you call them. That group met later than the groups that were working on the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices. So it's actually a little more current, reflects a little more current knowledge on some of these issues, and is stronger language. It's not yet a regulation. However, it is the only federal standard out of the Access Board on this topic, so it carries a lot of weight and should be deferred to, and is very likely to be the basis for any regulations that follow. So let me give you some idea of some of the things you should be looking for in your pedestrian signals. First, if there is a push button that controls the signal, it must have a locator tone. It must be, and there are specifications for how long the beep on the locator tone is, and the sound is between 2 and 5 dBs is to adjust for ambient sound. Also, it's designed to be heard no more than 5 to 12 feet from the crosswalk or the building line, whichever is closer. So these things are getting much, much quieter, and people are still able to find them and use them effectively. For the low vision people, the button must have 70% contrast with its background, and it must have a visual and audible indicator that the button has been pressed, so you get some feedback so that you know the thing is alive and working. The face of the push button must be parallel to the crosswalk, no closer than 30 inches to the curb. So shouldn't have to stand practically in the street to deal with your accessible pedestrian signal. This is an important distinction now between this document and the MUTCD. The MUTCD says audible or vibrotactile. Either one's okay under the MUTCD. Under the latest report out of the Access Board, vibrotactile only is not permitted. Audible and vibrotactile. The vibrotactile has not been a huge success here in the United States. It works better in some other countries, but here we're just not that standardized in where we place the poles and where the crosswalk is. And so if you have something that only vibrates, it can be very difficult to get to the crosswalk when you need to in time to have the full advantage of all the crossing time. So that's an important distinction. Keep that in mind. Audible and vibrotactile is required under the Public Rights of Way Accessibility Committee report. The signal must also unambiguously indicate which crossing has the walk signal. And the use of two different tones to accomplish that is no longer permitted. For example, the cuckoo chirps, where you have to know that the cuckoo applies to one crossing and know that the chirp applies to the other crossing, and that's the only information you have to go on. Now they will have to provide additional information for you to know which crossing the signal applies to. And they can do that in a variety of ways, and they're actually getting creative. Some are using verbal messaging to tell you which street has the crossing. Placement is an important issue. If there are two push buttons at one corner, they must be separated by 10 feet. That helps tremendously in audibly being able to distinguish which one is going off at any time. However, we know that in this country there are some places where we can't get that separation, and there are often two push buttons on one pole, and they are required to find a way to unambiguously indicate which crossing has the walk signal. The push button must also have a tactile arrow that points in the direction of the crossing. It will not point to the curb cut if there is one. It's used to orient you to in the direction that you should be traveling when you're crossing that street. The push button must also have the street name that's controlled by the button. Tactile, raised characters, and Braille, like we have in all other ADAG signage requirements. So that's just a few of the things. Some of these things that I've mentioned have detailed specifications within them, something you just need to get familiar with and make sure you provide to your the people that you're working with at the local level to get your signals. I have a couple of signals here, and I'm going to try to demonstrate some of these things that I just talked about.
Hello.
This first one is a Polara. Can we get a microphone up here?
To the signal. to cross Broadway. Walk sign is on to cross Broadway. Walk sign is on to cross Broadway. Walk sign is on to cross Broadway.
This is the walk signal. I'm
fine. Walk sign is on to cross Broadway. Walk sign is on to cross Broadway.
I've got the push button. I can't find the locator.
I'm not going to switch here.
No, it's a different machine.
Charlie is not crossing Broadway.
Working. Shit. Oh, well. I'll go to the other one. Okay, give up. We're going to go to the Prisma Tech. Can you hear that? The locator tone? Okay. And then when I call for the push button, the walk signal, did you hear the audible indication? Okay. In a minute, it will give it to me. That's the walk signal.
Sounds like a machine gun.
It does. Okay, this is the same machine, a little different tone. This is called a night tone. I don't know why they don't use it in the daytime, too. Sounds more pleasant to me, but you can turn it down at night. And all the signals now, of course, adjust for ambient sound. So they should never be louder than they really need to be. Okay. One more point I wanted to make on this. The repetition rate, you notice where we're using a tone, and then you have a locator tone, that's a little slower, and then when you get the walk signal, it's very fast. The proportion is required in the standard, so it specifies that the walk signal must be faster than the locator tone. However, you do not have to use that type of tone as your walk indication. The first machine that we saw announced the street and said, walk sign, Broadway. You can use that as well as just a tone. I'm going to turn it over to you. Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Charlie Crawford. He's going to talk about advocacy.
Okay. I'm going to stand up. Right?
Is there a podium there? Yeah, there's a podium right here.
All right. Where's Lainey?
From here.
Okay.
Microphone. Okay.
So you're after me, right, Lainey?
Yeah.
Good morning, everyone.
There's a question.
And a pleasant Thursday morning it is. I am... want a couple of minutes to share with you how to get this done in your communities and in your states and localities, because our next challenge is not going to be so much establishing what the standards are, because the MUTC tends to take care of that, nor what the mandate is, because the public rights of way rules that will ultimately come from the Access Board and therefore provide you folks with a set of expectations of new development in your communities will take care of that. The issue then becomes, if you have a law and if you have standards but you don't have accessible pedestrian signals, somebody has to look at why. And there are a number of reasons that that happens. Many of you in this audience are sophisticated advocates and have already done a fair amount of this on your own with your local communities, and you know some of those reasons. Probably the one we hear most often. Can you hear me all right? Probably the one that we hear most often is that, first, the standards are not clear, or the standards aren't in place, and we have to operate using those standards. And that's an easy one to resolve, because you can share copies of the manual of traffic, uniform traffic control devices with the community decision makers, usually traffic engineers, and they can relate to that. The second argument's a little more tricky, and that is they will tell you that, Well, we understand that there's disagreement in your community about whether or not these things are really necessary, and we don't want to put anything in that's going to upset anybody. And that argument, at least on the surface, sounds fairly reasonable. The problem is, and the answer is, two things. First, that it really is irrelevant who likes them or doesn't like them. The reality is that the information conveyed at intersections to people, the walk, don't walk information, needs to be made available to all citizens of the community. It wasn't just put there for people who can see it. It was put there for traffic safety and for pedestrian safety so that people can freely cross the intersection using the rules of the road in this case. So that notion of program access, meaning that the city or the town or the state or the county has installed these signals for the benefit of all its citizens, and therefore all of its citizens have an inherent right to access that information, that argument is available to you both under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, presuming that the city or town receives federal financial assistance, or secondly under the ADA, which is pretty much the same language, that no individual, understand that word individual, can be discriminated against simply because they have a disability. Yes.
Can you get to a microphone?
Is there a microphone that you can get to? I mean, I can hear you, but I'm not sure everybody else can.
No, we can't.
Four microphones are available? And for those of you in the internet audience, video description is this. A person attempts to find a microphone. And hopefully somebody's getting there. Okay, go ahead.
Me or the other person?
Who is me?
Oh, I'm sorry. Carl from Thornton from Wakefield, Virginia.
Go ahead.
Well, I guess when I cross, I feel like a chicken trying to cross the road.
Uh-huh. We haven't got accessible signals for chickens yet, but go on.
Well, it's just to the point. I stay in a small town, and I try working with the state, and really cannot get any help trying to cross the road.
Uh-huh. Well, I will answer that question in just a minute. There was another person with a question. I'm not ignoring your question, but there's something we need to talk about there.
Charlie, this is Sean Cox from the Portsmouth, Virginia area.
Hi, John. Sean. You guys in Virginia have a problem, too.
Yeah. To my knowledge, as far as I know, now this, you know, pennies for my thoughts, of course, I guess, but as far as I know, in the Portsmouth area, we, where I live in my community, do not have any audible traffic signals.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a guide dog, and we have two major highways that run within blocks of where I live, and I have seen times where Ricky and I both have come within inches of being hit by an automobile simply for the fact that they don't want to stop. And I'm just kind of, my question to you is, what, and I guess it's kind of in conjunction with Carlton's question, what do we have to do to get these audible traffic signals implemented in the areas where they are most needed?
Okay. Well, let's cut right to the chase here then. The only way that somebody is going to decide to install pedestrian signals if they see first that there's a need for them, and that is established if there already is an a pedestrian signal at that intersection conveying information of when a person can walk or not walk, then that establishes the need, because if it's good enough for sighted people, it's good enough for blind people. Second, then, issue is, well, who's going to pay for it? And the third issue is, who authorizes that accessible signal to be put in? The two issues of who's going to pay for it and who authorizes it are fairly important but can be overcome. The first is, with respect to who's going to pay for it, the cost of these things is pretty inexpensive. The estimate that we have for the actual signal is about $500 per signal times 8 signals on a intersection, assuming it's a four-way intersection. That's, what, $4,000?
Yep.
So that is not a whole lot of money when you consider that the cost of installing a signal in the first place is real high. I don't know what the actual... Do you know, Julie?
$75,000.
How much? $100,000?
$100,000.
All right. So what you're talking about is about 4% of the cost of the actual signal installation. That's your first argument in terms of cost. The second is that you can access both community block grant monies from the federal government as well as T21 or transportation.
Yeah, this is Ray Campbell from Illinois.
Hey, Ray.
Just a quick comment, and I put this on the ACBL list, but I want to say it here too. We're talking a lot about signals, and yes, we should be doing that, but we also need to advocate in our local communities to make sure we have good sidewalks and curb cuts, etc., so we can get to the signals.
That's right.
And one of the big things you can do is be involved with your local government and make sure if these developers come in and say, well, I don't want to put sidewalks in, you make the village board or whoever say, you will put sidewalks in. The second thing I have is a question. We went down to Champaign County, Illinois, and said to them that we'd like to have some signals put in. They want to do that. There's 8 intersections in the Champaign-Urbana area. For those of you not familiar, it's where the University of Illinois is located. A lot of blind people in that area.
Yep.
And they said, yeah, but we've already got our federal money committed for 5 years. How do we handle that type of situation?
Well, in the first instance... my response to them would be, look at your federal money again, see whether or not there's additional federal dollars you can attract, or there are ways that you can use the money you have currently and to install these signals. The second level of argument is, all right, assume you have no federal money. We're not waiting for our lives to be dependent upon when you plan federal money. This is a need we have now. You need to find a way to get these signals installed. I mean, be insistent about it, because what they want you to do is basically buy whatever they're telling you and go away. You don't need to do that. The reality is that if you're not successful in your initial negotiation and they're basically stonewalling you, then file a complaint with the Department of Justice, or you can file it with us at the National Office, and we'll file it for you with the Department of Justice, and that will raise the ante so that the cities and towns begin to pay a little more attention to you. I don't want to turn this, though, into a situation where you always have to look in terms of confrontation. I mean, I don't have a problem with confrontation, but I'd rather see us meet with city councils first, talk with the committees they have to deal with traffic issues and pedestrian issues, and to get them on your side when it comes to arguing for the dollars and the mandate to get things done. Also, there's a metropolitan planning organization that usually exists within the larger cities have their own. Smaller cities probably have a regional planning organization. Find out who that is from your mayor's office and get in touch with those folks and talk to them about what do you have planned here, how are we going to fit in accessible pedestrian signals to ensure that those traffic areas where there's a high degree of danger get dealt with immediately. And that brings us to another issue that you need to know about. Many of the traffic engineers are now using or trying to use some kind of point system which they use to determine whether or not the installation of a pedestrian signal is warranted. And that process can, in some cases, actually be beneficial because they will give points to things like lead pedestrian interval, where the pedestrians are allowed to go first and then the light changes for the cars to turn. So that if you don't know that because you can't see the signal, you start going with the parallel traffic and you're in real trouble because they've already had the phase for pedestrians and now it's the car's turn. So that's a real dangerous situation and gets a lot of points on these scales that they develop for warranting whether or not to install a signal. You should be a part of that process. You should be talking with your traffic engineers, ask them what they use for criteria when they're considering accessible pedestrian signals for installation, and then make this point and make it loud and clear. We are willing to accept a point system that goes to the implementation priority of where to install signals. We are not in a position to accept the notion that under any circumstances a blind person should be denied an accessible pedestrian signal simply because they didn't meet some point structure. It is essentially their civil right under the ADA to have that. Now, I understand that that does create a little bit of tension, but the reality is if you buy into a point system that ultimately may decide that you don't really need this accessible pedestrian signal, then what you've done is cut your advocacy off at the start, and you have no recourse. Well, you certainly do have recourse, but the point is that it's not going to work as well if you don't establish it with them, that this is a priority situation rather than an absolute one. What we did in Maryland, for example, is we have a fairly good point system that's been developed for determining the installation of a pedestrian signal. And what we said was we will accept this as a priority. So, for example, if you have an intersection where there's a lot of cars turning and there's lead pedestrian intervals and different directions of traffic and all that sort of thing versus an intersection that is more or less pretty quiet and fairly easy to cross, although it would be good to have the accessible pedestrian signal, then clearly you want to give the priority to the more dangerous situation. That's reasonable, and that's something that we should be willing to work with the traffic engineers. But on the other hand, at some point you're going to reach a point where those major intersections have been dealt with, and you have other intersections which still pose a risk to blind people, and if a blind person wants to have that level of assistance in terms of access to the information crossing that intersection, they should not be denied simply because somebody's point system decided they don't need it. That gets to the issue of that community agreement issue again.
Charlie?
Let me just finish this point. There was an article in the Des Moines Register, I think it was the July 1st, that essentially was fairly complimentary to the convention, but did mention one of the members of the commission for the Iowa Department for the Blind making some statement about, well, blind people don't really need accessible pedestrian signals because it draws attention to their blindness. Now, that in and of itself is okay for a personal opinion. I'm not sure that in the context of a commissioner or a commission governing the Department for the Blind, I would necessarily accept that argument as an appropriate argument to make, and we may do something about that, clearly. But the point here is that when people hear that in the public, they say, oh, well, they don't need them. And the nice thing that traffic engineers can rely upon, if somebody says they don't need them, then you don't have to spend the money to put them in. So it's a real incentive to traffic engineers to not install pedestrian signals when they hear that argument about lack of agreement in the community. Again, we have to be real clear that it's not about agreement in the community. It's about your safety crossing the street, our safety crossing the street in those places where we need to have that protection. And one last quick fact on that is that we know, this is not speculation, we know that at least 23 people on average, who are visually impaired every year are killed in pedestrian accidents. Now, you average that out over a course of 12 months, and you're close to one person every 2 weeks. That's not an acceptable ratio. Zero is the only acceptable ratio when it comes to pedestrian safety. You got a question?
Charlie.
Charlie, have a...
There, the gentleman first. Who's that?
Jim Eccles, Washington State.
Jim Eccles?
Yes.
Hey.
Close. Hey, Charlie.
This guy has done great work with the Voting Access Task Force. He's really helped a lot. Sorry, Jim, go ahead.
Thank you. I lived until April of last year in what was an ideal community. In the city and rural county where I lived, there were 12 audible signals installed. And at a local chapter meeting, when we discussed with the two traffic engineers, one city, one county, the cost of the installation of these things, they said, look, it costs us $10,000 to retrofit intersections, you know, for emergency vehicles, you know, when they roll through and use the strobes or whatever that make all the lights east-west green so an ambulance or emergency vehicle can go that way or north-south. They said, your little $3,000 or $4,000 request is piddling. It doesn't even show up on the radar screen. So we had 12 installations, and 100% of all requests for audible traffic signals at specific intersections had been met by the city and the county. Then the local chapter of the NFB said, well, now we want to start having an ad hoc committee meet of the two organizations in the city
right.
to go over these requests. Well, I rather stupidly said, well, if 100% of the requests are being met, why does there need to be a meeting if it isn't? If it's fixed, let's not break it. Well, obviously the agenda was to break it, because when we had this meeting in April of 2000, the outcome of the meeting was that we prioritized a set of additional intersections to be retrofitted with audible signals that this group that showed up at the meeting decided upon. The local president of the NFB said he very much, in fact, didn't want specific signals installed unless things came before this group, which sort of meant an individual, they might want a signal, but unless the local group decided they needed one, well, they might not get it. And then they said, we don't know if you're going to have a system, we don't know which system is the best, so we'd like there to be some kind of a study. And then once the local traffic engineering staff has kind of done a study of what's available out there and rated which one is the best, we can meld together the priority list of intersections to be retrofitted and the specific system that we've decided to use, and then start acting on that list. And since April of 2000, Charlie, not one single solitary traffic signal has been installed in a community that previously had installed a dozen.
Right. I'd suggest to you that you find out who your ADA officer is for that jurisdiction and ask for a meeting with that person and tell them that the jurisdiction or the locality is engaging in an administrative practice. Understand these words. An administrative practice that defeats the purpose of both Section 504 and the ADA, because it precludes the right of an individual to request and receive accommodations from their local government. And if that person has a problem with that, ask them to call us.
Charlie.
Okay, Charlie.
I'm going to take two more questions, then I want to get to
the meeting.
This
is Michael Barber.
Charlie.
This is Michael Barber. I think I had the floor first.
Yeah.
I just had a question. Well, first of all, if indeed one of the members of the commission for whom I work...
Wellstone is his name?
What?
Wellstone, is that the name?
Wellman, John Wellman,
that's
probably.
It.
Yeah. If he really made that statement, I'm kind of distressed about that. That's, you know, my cane calls attention to my blindness, so should I quit carrying it? But anyway. my question is, are there standards for the length of traffic signals? Where I live, they widened the intersection.
Right.
And all of a sudden, I was noticing that I didn't have time to get across that intersection. And so when I talked to the traffic engineer, they went out and checked, and by golly, they had to add 4 seconds to that thing
right.
because they had forgotten to change that. I don't know if there are standards, but even what they added almost doesn't give a person enough time to get safely across this intersection. And I wanted to know, either from you or Julie, are there standards?
Yes. The manual uniform traffic control devices, again, controls many things outside of pedestrian signals, per se. They do give you, the current standard is 4 seconds per foot. That's right. I'm sorry. 4 feet per second. So that's that is considered to be enough time for a person to get across the street, but the new standard is going to be 3.5 feet per second, so that you'll have a little longer to get across. And these things are not etched in stone, though. So if you have a problem crossing your intersection and there's just not enough time, then you need to talk to the traffic engineers, because either one of two things can be happening. First, they may be giving you too little time to cross, or in a second circumstance, there may be other phases associated with the traffic light that are either interfering with or affecting your ability to cross the street. Sometimes you have more time than you think, but the information conveyed to you isn't giving you that proper timing. So a conversation with a traffic engineer can usually resolve that, and I'm glad that you brought that point up.
Charlie.
Let's take just a couple more questions, and then I want to move on to Lainey, who has, who's the money lady. Go on. Somebody said Charlie.
Yeah, this is Robert A. Jones from Jacksonville, Florida.
Robert, and then one other person I heard just before Robert. Okay, go on, Robert.
You want me to go?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My argument, counterposing the NFP's philosophy, if these traffic engineers and city councilmen and mayors, whatever, want to go along with that philosophy, my argument then is that we know that the sighted community can get across that street. Therefore, they don't need walk lights.
Well, you're absolutely right. How do you argue that? You know, the water's wet? Yeah, sure it is. I think that the thing we need to talk, you know, if somebody raises the Federation philosophy, let's not be totally negative on that. I mean, the reality is that, sure, with proper training and opportunity, there's a whole lot of things that we can do. And we all know that. The issue is when you take a philosophy and you stretch it beyond its reasonable application. That's the issue here. If we simply go on the argument that this or that draws attention to us as blind people, first of all, so what? The second issue is, let's assume that an employer out there decides that, oh, I saw a blind person crossing a street and had to use this thing that went beep, beep, beep as he crossed the street. I can't hire that person. Now, is that rational? I mean, does that make any sense to anybody? This, you know, there's a point where any philosophy reaches a ridiculous extreme, and that's a good example of it. There was one other question?
Well, can I just add a couple more comments? It was pointed out that...
Okay, talk fast.
monies that have been thrown in for transportation, et cetera, only 1% of that goes toward the pedestrian.
Right.
But the other statistic that helps us out a little bit is that 12% of the traffic accidents and deaths are attributable to pedestrians. Therefore, our safety is definitely jeopardized in attempting to cross those streets, sighted or blind.
I'd like our distinguished attorney, Julie Carroll, to respond.
I just wanted to point out that 1% is how much is spent on pedestrians currently. It's not how much is available to be spent. There is a lot more money available and that has been authorized to be spent on pedestrian things. So that's a choice that has been made by the people spending your tax dollars.
That's it. One other question. There was somebody over there.
Charlie. Bobby Burke from Charlottesville, Virginia.
Hey, Bobby. How you doing?
For the people in Virginia, they should try to find their MPO in a big area because they have listened to me at times. I've had to sit there for hours because the ADA stuff is usually at the end. But I really don't have to worry about the NFB because they never show up to any of these meetings. But they still try to, you know, enforce things. But the people have also tried to get the stuff done where I've noticed that if I try to get the audible signals placed in an area where they're trying to put in new lights for a new road, that usually is a lot easier for them to do. But I also try to get them to do the other stuff.
In the interest of fairness, the Federation is actually beginning to soften a whole lot on this whole issue, probably because they realize that there's no way they can continue to argue such a silly position and maintain credibility in the blind community. So that is important to recognize. The best way to sum up what I've had to say is by the experience of one of our members in upstate New York. Now, this gentleman has attempted for years to get an accessible pedestrian signal on a particular street, and he's met nothing but bureaucratic excuse after bureaucratic excuse. When ACB National got involved, 3 weeks later, he's got a letter from the local traffic engineer advising the state that they need to do something about this because, after all, this guy has a right to that pedestrian signal. And this is after the guy had given up personally. And I think that's the important piece to remind people about. Don't give up. Don't give up. it's hard. And they will give you lots of reasons why they can't do things. But be persistent. And remember, you've got us on your side, and you can't lose that way. And one last speaker over there, a lady.
Got a comment here.
A Metropolitan Planning Organization.
Got a comment here for you, Charlie.
Okay, and that's the last one because I want to introduce Laney after that. Okay,
right.
Go ahead.
Alan Beatty.
Hey, Alan, you did a great job on that folk music, man, I'll tell you.
Hey, thank you. We did a great job on traffic signals, too. Our city engineering said we can't afford them. Found out the price of them. I went to the Lions Club. Lions clubs are buying the traffic signals now for our city. I also have the Rotary Club, and the Kiwanis are willing to buy into it too, as long as they can put their signal or their signage up on the box.
Fantastic.
So we've taken that excuse away from the traffic engineering people.
That's a great strategy, you know. And I would recommend anybody who has a friend who has some money, not much, is willing to buy one of the signals, take it down to City Hall and say, "Here, we're giving it to you now. Put it in."
Yeah. But the other point I want to make is that all of our chapters, all of our affiliates in this United States should have a representative either sitting in or good friends with the traffic engineering department.
Yes.
Go down and get acquainted with them. Buy them the coffee. It'll buy you an awful lot of goodwill.
That's right.
Thank you, Charlie.
And remember, thank you for making that comment. The traffic engineers are the ones that worked with us, not against us. With us to get the right language in the MUTCD in January. They are on our side. There are a lot of people in that world out there on our side, and certainly use them as your friends because they are. Can I now...
Handouts.
What?
We have pedestrian safety handbooks.
Yes, we do. Pedestrian safety handbook. That's my little Bible.
We have Braille, tape, and large print, and disc.
And thanks so much to Debbie Grubb and all the people that worked on the information that's in that handbook. It's a wonderful handbook. If you, if you'll indulge me for just 1 second, there are some people that you instantly like, people that, you know, you say to yourself, whoa, this is the kind of person I want to have a friendship with, person that really is on our side. And Laney Feingold is certainly one of those persons. And she has spearheaded the effort with the California Council of the Blind and other affiliates to work on this whole issue of ATMs access. So once we get across the street to the ATM, something's got to happen. And how? Here's the lady to tell you how you can get money. Laney? There you go.
Thank you.
Yours.
Thank you. Okay, well, when I saw the topic in the program, I thought, oh, how did Charlie string these two issues together, getting to the ATM safely? And I'm thinking that was creative. But as I heard the discussion this morning, I realized that there's a lot of common issues with ATMs, with traffic signals. We have the technology, we have the law on our side, and the question is how to get the people in charge to do the right thing. And the arguments we hear on the ATMs are similar to what you're saying about the traffic signals. Oh, it costs too much. We don't know what the regulations really are. We need to wait. People don't really want them. People don't really use them. And so advocacy around talking ATMs is actually, I think, quite similar to advocacy around a lot of issues in the blindness community. So what I'd like to do is just take a few seconds, really, to just give you the background of talking ATMs. First, let me ask, has everyone in this room tried the Bank of America talking ATM that Mike Barber arranged?
Good. Wow.
And if anybody hasn't, I really urge you to try it, especially today between 12 to 2 or 4 to 7, because the Bank of America staff person is there. And I cannot tell you, just to follow up on what the last commenter said about making friends with the traffic engineers, the bank people need to hear that the community wants these things, the community likes these things. It's amazing how much one person telling about their experience, or a bank person just hearing once, whoa, you know, I'm a professional and I'm 30 and I've never withdrawn cash from an ATM machine. And you could just, you know, see the light bulbs go off. So if you haven't tried it, try it. If you haven't talked to the Bank America person, he's going to be here, I think, through tomorrow. Stop by, tell him what you think of the machine. It'd be really great. Okay, there are now over 600 talking ATMs in the United States. There is 12 talking ATMs in Canada, and that is it for talking ATMs in the universe. So we've done a great job so far, mostly thanks to the affiliates of the ACB who have worked on this issue for years and years, people like Julie who are writing the regulations, you know, shall I say how many years ago, you know. There's talking ATMs in California, Florida, Illinois, Kentucky, Ohio, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Hampshire, New York, Pennsylvania, and Washington, D.C. And if I was standing up here 6 months from now, I'd probably have another 8 states. And a year from now, I'd probably have another 15 states. So one thing I really want to urge people, if you're in a state with a talking ATM, find out where it is and use it. We're going to try to, I think, put all the locations up on the ACB website, or I can give you our website where we have the locations. People can come up to me afterwards. I'll give you my contact information. The banks, the truth is, are putting counters in these machines deep into the program, and they're counting every month how many people in the blindness community are using the talking ATMs. And we all know that it's going to take many years for talking ATMs, well, first of all, until they're everywhere, they're almost nowhere. Because if it's not in your community, near where you shop, near where you live, near where you work, chances are you're not going to use it. That's why they have ATMs everywhere. But if you can make an effort to go out of your way, pay the dollar surcharge or the $2 surcharge, it's really going to go a long way. I think if everyone's tried the talking ATM with Bank of America, I don't need to go over sort of how they work. Some of the key issues, if you're talking to people about this, they are private. None of them have speakers. That's the first question a lot of people ask. They're private. They work with headphones that the banks are giving out for free. You can use standard Walkman-type headphones with them. So they're private. Right now, they're doing almost every function that a sighted person can do on an ATM. Withdrawals, deposits, transfers. You can hear your account balance. You can, you know, set your PIN number on ATMs that have PIN numbers. You can buy stamps. So I would say that the technology, we started a year and a half ago with the first one in the United States, and every 6 months we're getting more functionality, the machines are getting better, and it's really a time, I think, in history for the floodgates to open and really try to get these things at every single bank. So the question is, what can you do in your home communities to make this happen? And, you know, it's like advocating for anything else. The first thing you have to do is ask for it. You know, you have to go from wanting it, complaining that you don't have it, to asking for it. Right now, it's the major financial institutions that have these. But the good news is they're starting to be smaller banks, and the price is starting to come down. We don't really know what they cost because the banks don't share that information with us, but I take that to mean it's not too expensive for a bank to install, because if it were, they would tell us. So I have done up a letter, and we have copies of the letter in Braille and large print, and I can also email it to people just as a sample to the first step. If you want to contact your financial institution and say, hey, have you heard about talking ATMs? We want one here. And I would say the most important thing is to any request to put it in writing. Because if you just ask your branch manager, the manager is going to say, oh, I don't remember that, and it's not going to go anywhere. The other thing to know is I want to just go over the major banks that the ACB legal team, which is what we like to call ourselves, even though in every state, you know, we're working with different affiliates and different individuals. We are working with a lot of national banks. So like Bank of America, for example, has talking ATMs in California and Florida right now, but they are committed to a talking ATM in every state where they do business, and they have over 10,000 ATMs. So if you're with a bank that is with one of the affiliates that if you bank with someone that we're already negotiating with, the best thing to do is to contact us and to say, hey, we want to be next on the Wells Fargo list, the Bank of America list, the Bank One list. And I have to put in a plug for Missouri over here because we had an article in the Penny's Journal, and said, if you want talking ATMs, contact us. And we got so many calls from the state of Missouri. We're thinking, like, are there like hundreds and millions of blind people in the state of Missouri? No, but the state of Missouri is organized. The state of Missouri got themselves together to City Hall. That ATM has to talk. Because we're going to have ramps, and we're going to have assistive listening systems, and we're not going to have an ATM that's not usable to the entire population. And to the credit of the San Francisco Federal Credit Union, they stepped up to the plate, and there are now 3 San Francisco Federal Credit Union talking ATMs in San Francisco. Now, they have given the talking ATM development work they've done to the credit union sort of parent network. So anyone who's particularly interested in credit unions can contact us, because there is no reason that an individual credit union should not be able to put a talking ATM in. One thing I should say is almost all the talking ATMs we have in the country now are upgrades of existing machines. They have an upgrade kit they put on an existing machine. So it's not about buying a whole new ATM. However, when your bank or your credit union does buy a new ATM, it's even less expensive to put in the access. Just like someone was saying, when you have the new street, it's easier to get the accessible signal. When you build a new building, it's easier to do the architectural access. The same is true for ATMs. So particularly if you're in a community that opens a new branch, you've been memorizing the sequence, you notice it's a different machine, that's a particularly good time to go to the bank and say, hey, you have put in something new. We want this to be accessible to all your consumers. The law is on our side here. Since 1992, the very first ADAG, thanks to Julie and other people, said ATM machines have to be independently usable to persons with vision impairments. And there is no way for an ATM to be independently usable unless it talks. So they are writing new regulations now. We are hoping that they'll be more specific in requiring talking ATMs. But don't let anyone tell you, well, the new regs aren't out yet, we don't know what to do. Since 1992, the old regs, in my mind, have required talking ATMs, and that's why we've been successful in getting the ATMs here. Yeah, is there a question over there?
Yeah, I have a question.
Right, 2 people are talking.
You need to get to a microphone. We are taping and streaming live, so let's let everybody hear what you have to say.
My question, and something that's been bugging me, is that these machines are not accessible to people who are deafblind or hard of hearing. And blind or visually impaired, and it seems like the law should guarantee them access also, and I don't want to go promoting something that's leaving out another group of people who clearly aren't hearing great numbers, and I'm wondering if any work has been done around that, and if work has been done with deaf blindness organizations to do something to make the machines more completely accessible?
Well, the effort has been on audio ATMs. So the effort has been on the jack, the software, so ATMs speak, because right now ATMs are totally visual. So for the issues for people with hearing impairments who can see don't come up because they can read the screen.
No, I said deaf. So, I said visually impaired and hard of hearing.
Deafblind.
Yeah,
deaf.
On the deafblind issue, I mean, that has not been where the efforts have been. We are trying to do little things in terms of people who are hard of hearing, this is an example of when it's new technology, how we have to always be advocating for every little piece of what we want. There, as of now, most of these machines don't even have volume control, which seems like such an easy thing. People used to listening to things. Why don't they have volume control? But in the course, in the context of an ATM, volume control has been, for some reason, a stickier proposition. We do hope by this summer to have volume control, at least in all the machines.
So, I mean, I'm concerned that, like, if we're saying if you put in a new machine, it's easier to make it accessible, and if there's no standards for screen enlargement and Braille, which for people for whom the audio would not be useful, who should be part of our constituency, that we at least know what's available or be talking to people about what's possible and be able to speak to that also?
This is Julie Carroll. I want to respond to that. There are requirements for the print and font and contrast and all that. The problem with the deaf-blind issue, we have included them every time we have gone to the table to work on these regulations. The problem is that refreshable Braille is not available in, maybe available, it's not really usable, particularly in an outside setting. They have not figured out how to do that.
Lainey, I have a question.
Okay.
A comment. I have a comment.
Well, can I just say one thing about the deaf-blind issue? There will be a solution. Mm-hmm. You know, let's not conclude that because we're not there yet that we won't get there. This is something that's important to us, like video description, where we have a development now that we may be able to get implemented that will allow for deaf-blind persons to have both access to visual and auditory information going on the television. We think we can get there with the accessible ATMs, but you're absolutely right, and you're not. You may be right now in the caboose, but the train's going to get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point, because the banks, most of the banks don't, almost all the banks don't develop their own ATMs. There's manufacturers that are doing it, and like I said before, every 6 months we are getting more access, and so it is a very continuous process, and anyone who participates advocating in any way in your own institution or anyone who, you know, puts her 2 cents in is going to have an effect on this process. I've just seen the change has been so tremendous in the last 18 months. Yeah, next question.
Yeah, I had a question. In our local area, there is a Bank of America that has a talking ATM, and very few of us are using it. And we wrote a letter, as in our chapter, we wrote letters saying why we don't use it. And that's the matter of safety. It's outside, and I don't know. I mean, sure, I can use the machine. I don't know if somebody's watching me across the street or, you know, whatever. And I know that you take your chances. I don't mind going into the bank and, you know, standing through the teller line if I have to. And if the machine was inside, I'd be willing to take my chances. But all of the ATM machines in that particular bank are outside. And so that's why so many of us aren't using it.
I think that's a really good point. And in all of this, there's been a lot of issues to juggle. And one of the reasons there's a lot of talking ATMs outside is because we have taken the position thus far that we want the machine with the longest hours of operation. And that is a tension between that concept that we want access every time the same hours a sighted person can have access. We want access. Versus the indoor issue, because if you go with the indoor over the outdoor, you get shorter hours. Now, the regulations are one ATM per location, and we are trying to possibly develop the idea that indoor and outdoor are separate locations, in which case you'd get indoor and outdoor. But it's just something that people need to talk about in their own communities. And if
I knew where it was.
You know, right now we're trying to push as hard as we can for 100% equal access on this, and that has meant equal hours of operation, which has meant more outdoor locations. So I think that's a really valid point you raise.
Lainey?
Yeah.
May I go ahead?
Uh-huh.
Thank you. I'm wondering, are you aware, Audley Blackburn from Austin, so you know he's talking, I think people should identify themselves. Are you aware that the transit industry in their light rail systems and often also just in their ticketing systems for their even their bus systems are going to very similar machines such as you're describing here with the ATMs where you go in, the thing is on the screen, it issues a ticket. So we're running into the very same problem in the transit industry to accessibility to purchasing the tickets as we are getting money out of the banks. And I'm wondering, are any thoughts being given to, you know, building on what we're doing here to address that issue?
Yeah, well, that's a good point, and something I want to say about using the ATMs, that even there's many reasons to use the ATMs. First and foremost is to use them to get money. But the other thing is to this technology is going to transit. It's going, like Julie was saying earlier, to federal government kiosks. The idea of a machine giving you things and information. You go to airports now and, you know, they all have kiosks that are totally inaccessible to sell you your tickets. So this is getting very high profile in the industry. There's a lot in the industry journals about the talking ATMs, and another reason to make sure they're used is to show that they're needed. Now, in terms of the fare machine, needed for the technology down the road, in terms of the fare machines, there are talking fare machines in some cities, and the current regulations are going to hopefully include fare machines, but you're right. The same kind of advocacy can be done, and in fare machines you have the arguments that Charlie was making about the signals, that they're often public government Title II entities. They're providing information and services. They have to provide that same information and services.
Lainey, does it make sense to talk to the manufacturers about some of these things? Because, for instance, as I'm sitting here, it occurred to me that one of the problems that might be addressed for deaf-blind people would be if instead of trying to put the refreshable braille on the machine, if you had a port that you could connect something like a braille light to it, that way somebody could bring the braille light to the ATM and connect it that way. But I'm not sure that anybody's tried to think of it that way.
The idea of talking to the manufacturers is important. One thing I should say is we have not filed any lawsuits to get these talking ATMs. We've approached the institutions, even though I'm a lawyer, we've approached the institutions and we've offered to negotiate and meet with them over this issue. And I think one of the reasons we've been successful is because that has enabled us to sit around the table with the manufacturers and the banks and the developers and the larger banks that have ATM divisions and try to work out some of these issues. So I would say we have channels now open with the manufacturing representatives, and we can present, you know, people have ideas, should share them with us, and they should be included in the mix, absolutely.
Let me just say something.
Go ahead, Charlie.
One of the issues with a universal access device or port is the extent to which there is an opportunity for mischief with respect to people not only outputting information but inputting information that isn't associated with their transaction, basically hacking into the machine. So we have to be careful on that, but I do believe that because we are in discussions now with both banks and manufacturers, these issues, especially the deafblind issue, are things that we need to pay attention to. And I do like that concept of the universal accessibility, and we have to find a way to get that done.
Is it my
Lainey?
Yeah.
David Ellenwood from Port Huron, Michigan. I noticed that Michigan National, on a couple of their ATM, I only used one once, and the only reason I was able to use it was the print was a little extra large than normal, and it was in a dark cove, sort of. Otherwise, the large print idea would work as a viable for a lot of elderly persons as well.
Right.
And I'm low vision. Although I would be willing to work with audio. Thank you.
Someone named Karen is absolutely next.
Thank you very much. I just have a suggestion that may work for some people as far as the deaf-blind issue. I know it will not work for everyone. But if you do have some hearing and you wear hearing aids with telephone coil, just use a regular set of headphones that go over the ear and then turn one of them down to telephone coil. That works for me. So I just wanted to suggest that maybe some people would be able to use that.
There was a comment from the audience that you can also use a neck loop. Yeah, the neck loop can be plugged right into the jack. The other thing about plugging things into jacks, this is totally off topic, but this is a great opportunity for press attention for your affiliate as well as for the bank. We have gotten great press on this issue, and there's just been great coverage, and the ACB affiliates involved in the issue have gotten great coverage on TV and radio and newspapers, so I really urge you to factor that in.
Well,
yeah.
Lainey?
Ray.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
First of all, I want to publicly thank you for your efforts in working with the individuals in Illinois. This is one thing that I have not totally had my hands in. People have had their hands in a lot deeper than I have, but it's just one thing. How can, like, say a Bank One, I know of a couple of locations. I'd like to see some of the next ATMs go. How can we work through you and get that done, at least get them looking at these locations to get a couple of more ATMs installed in a few places?
Yeah, let me. We have an 800 number, which maybe, Roger, do you know it? I don't know our 800 number, but I do know our universal email, and I'll give you my own phone number. You can say, anyone who has any questions about this can send an email to banks, B-A-N-K-S, at the four letters, S like Sam, G, D like dog, B like boy, dot, says to be D, law.com, sgdblaw.com. And that's where that's the easiest way to process information requests. My office...
One more time, the email.
Oh, the email. It's banks, B-A-N-K-S, at four letters, S, G, D like David, B like boy, law.com. Right. Roger, you don't know the 800 number? Okay. We have an 800 number. And anyone can come up after.
I like to ask something.
Yeah. I can be reached at 510-548-5062, and people should really feel free to give me a call. Like I say, we did up this sample letter. We have it in large print and braille for people to take back with them. I can send it on email. It's just an example of how you could contact your bank in the first instance and get the ball rolling. And it says on the bottom of that letter, CC ACB National Office, or ACB Talking ATM Project, because we want to keep track of your efforts around the country. And it may well be that there needs to be a lawyer involved down the road, but I really do think the best start is for affiliates or individuals to make the contact, make it in writing, see what response you get back from the bank, and then, you know, send it to us at the ACB office, and we can talk about it further. Yeah, the phone is 510-548-5062.
Of course, realizing this is also being streamed on the Internet, you might get some calls from the Ukraine or something.
Yeah, it's my fault. I don't have the 800 number.
I'd like to make a statement by my local bank, the Wells Fargo in Hollywood, Cal. They've been very cooperative with me and trying to help me learn how to operate the equipment. And the safety factor, again, is my problem. I don't like to use it. They even offered to let the security guard go out and stand outside on the street with me and make sure people stay away from me when I'm running the thing, and told me how to put my hand over the buttons when you're pushing them and so forth. That's fine during company working hours, but, you know, it's not very good otherwise. But I'm hoping that maybe sooner or later that some of us can sit down and work with the banks. The banks seem to be very, very happy. Wells Fargo does, anyway, to communicate with me and try to help me with them, this problem. And also, you know, I think there should be a committee in each community that would sit down and work with the local banks to work it out. I've noticed on the Bank of America machine here, last night I tried four times to get $20 out of it, and I couldn't even get a dollar out. So it kept giving me slips of paper, but it didn't say what the slip of paper says on it. Unless you can find someone around sight that can read it to you. And secondly, the other day when I did work it with the B of A people here, they gave me two bills, and they showed me where it was at and handed them to me, but they didn't tell me what they were, and I had to ask, and it's plain out there was two tens rather than a 20.
Well, I think
now,
that's
most times they always gave 20s out.
I think that's a fitting comment on which to end, because it shows that this job is not done. There is a lot. And we need all of your help. I want to thank you for all being interested in the issue and the support, and turn it back to Julie.
Thank you, Lainey. I want to get these handouts out. I know a lot of us want to get to caucuses. We have them here And Barbara's going to run around and pass them out. And if we have any other sighted assistants who could help Barbara distribute these, please.
Can I just take 10 seconds to say that there are two ideas that came up for me this morning, the deafblind issue and the safety issues. I really do appreciate you bringing them up. It's something that's now incorporated, at least in my consciousness. And as we think about strategy, we will certainly deal with those issues.
Charlie? Barb? I can't get to microphones easily, but most ATMs have cameras, video cameras.
Right.
I know we can't see them, but most everybody that have them.
The comment is that most ATMs have video cameras.
Barbara, are you ready?
So that they may find out what happened after it happened.
No, it's quite often a deterrent was my point, because they do take pictures of them, and most sighted people know that.
Right.
And it doesn't stop them. They still do it. But still, that offers some measure of help anyhow, I think.
Remember that our goal is only equal protection. So, unfortunately, to the extent to which a sighted person is at risk, so are we sometimes, and we need to deal with that. I'm not sure what the solution is, but we certainly can dialogue about it and find one.
Excuse me, Charlie?
Yes?
This is Darian Hartman from Portland, Oregon. Was there an 800 number?
There was, but Lainey doesn't remember it.
Oh, okay. And I just want to say that Portland, Oregon has over 40 audible signals, and our traffic engineers are totally cooperating and, in fact, leading the ball, and we're so excited.
We know your traffic engineers, and we appreciate the help they've given us in a number of areas. If you want to call the National Office 800 number, that's 800-424-8666, 800-424-8666, after 2 o'clock Eastern Time on normal business days. So we have a lot of abnormal business days, too. But give us a call, and we'll give you that 800 number for Lainey.
Oh, thank you.
The handouts are coming around. Is this system working, or do we need to raise hands for each type of format, Barbara? What would be easier? Okay. This is working. Okay. They're on their way. A lot of this is also, of course, on the ACB website.
And thank you so much for being here. Let's go get some money. Door prize. We'll give away a free ATM machine. Yeah. Are you up now?
The Justice Department's full of idiots.
All right.
Basically. Yeah. I can't get them to back me.
Well, it helps if I turn the microphone on, doesn't it? That concludes our coverage of the breakout session on getting to the ATM safely. The issues covered were pedestrian access and accessible automatic teller machines. And that concludes the morning's general session coverage, but at 2 o'clock we will be back on air live, so that's in just 2 hours' time, and we're going to be broadcasting live some programming from the American Council of the Blind Governmental Employees. A couple of interesting and vital topics under discussion this afternoon. Why is the unemployment rate among Americans still at 70%? And also looking at the whole question of Section 508 of the Rehab Act. In a short time, those of you listening to this live, you'll be able to hear some rebroadcasting of this morning's proceedings, and we'll break into that at 2 o'clock for around about 3 hours additional live programming. A further reminder that we will be broadcasting the banquet coverage tomorrow evening, and lots of special things happening there. We will not be streaming the Candidates Forum this evening due to its location. It wasn't possible for us to move it in here so we could stream it, so we apologise for that if you were hoping to hear it. But of course there will be full coverage of ACB's elections tomorrow, including hopefully, if his schedule permits, and he's certainly hoping that it will, President Paul Edwards will explain exclusively to the ACB radio audience at about 8:15 tomorrow morning how the procedures work, especially for those of you who've never been to convention before. Perhaps you're an international listener and want to hear, understand how ACB's constitution works before proceedings begin. So there's lots more to come from Des Moines, Iowa. Thank you for listening and for your emails to convention@acbradio.org, and please stay tuned. In the meantime, good afternoon from Des Moines.